This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on, Larry. Come on. We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be.
It is contagious. It is the place to be, and we are live each and every Monday.
Do you actually need a camera for tout, or is it like part of the program?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself.
I'm just the man you see and the place to be.
Do you listen at all when I speak on the show?
I'm not the one who thrives on whining about carriages that are 3 inches from my fucking car.
So if it's too much for you and your big cock of the walk Knights of Columbus fat cat,
when does it end, JR?
Back to the fucking thing, then what do you want? What do you want?
When does it end?
You're making the poor guy making minimum wage while you're sitting there with our mento going through the coffers. Party people in the place to be.
5 years. 5 years we've been doing podcasts, and we have this. This is trash.
It's not Austin in L.A. It's not Cabana in Chicago. It's not Conrad down in Alabama. Place to Be Nation presents Scott Criscolo and JT Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
You can do worse than Josh Richards.
He's always dancing as you know. So bring me some shoes with lots of soul.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to a great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. We're your host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening inside the PTBN studios. Joining me, as always, my PIC, who I'll be seeing this week, because it is, of course, the best week of the year, and that is Thanksgiving week. Joining me tonight is Scott Criscolo. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 505 of the continuously longest-running episodic motherfucking gold dance. Yeah, it is. I get pumped about this week every year. Lots of fun and frivolity in the few days. Stuff to plan and enjoy this weekend. So, obviously, you're amped up. Always your favorite. Again, always your favorite week of the year.
Yeah, yeah. And we're on tonight at 5:05 live, this episode.
Yes.
It's a big. It's funny.
We got a lot of guys in this show that probably would fit that. That would fit that promotion. So.
You see one of them this weekend at the basketball game. So this it's funny time. We were talking about this earlier today. How I feel like we always kind of luck into this. The way these shows fall, we don't plan any of these things. Like
right.
We talked about how $4.99 was SummerSlam 88 with D'Amato. Like that was cool, and. And, like, the time we talked about Trump, what happened to be, like, the night he was elected president, you know, like, at WrestleMania.
Right.
Like, we've happened to back into these things quite a bit. And it's pretty funny how we're talking tonight, Survivor Series, on Thanksgiving week. Again, we don't plan any of this stuff, but it's pretty fun how we've been almost the year of 88. We've kind of been along with them, like, timing of the year-wise, which has been interesting. So, anyway.
Exactly.
I thought it was a,
yes.
Neat little fact today. But why don't we go ahead and bring in our third man tonight. He is a veteran of Place to Be Nation and the Place to Be podcast. However, he's actually never joined us for a Vintage Vault. It seems to be a common thread lately, Scott. So we're going to continue to bring in new voices on these shows and rotate guys in and girls. But joining us tonight is the co-host of the longest-running Fuck Shit Junk something-something comic show. He is, of course, my friend and yours. You heard him on Talking Pop, Talking 90210. He's the Dylan to my Brandon, and that is Mr. Gregory Phillips. Greg, how are you?
I am doing wonderful, and you did perfect with the introduction of my co-hosted podcast, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am here representing my life partner, Nick Duke, and proud to be here on the mothership. To give a little thoughts on a certainly a unique show, one might say.
Quite unique. And I guess that makes Scott the Napasuccio of our group here. So there you go.
Oh, no way. No, absolutely not. Never mind. I was going to make a Scott Scanlon joke, but I'm not.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's whatever. Maybe that's better. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, we are talking Survivor Series 88. Mm-hmm. But I was telling Greg before we went on air, I had kind of a harrowing day. Nothing major, but like this one of those days where little things just keep piling up and driving you insane. But one of the biggest things that annoyed me was this morning I had to put my daughter on the bus. So I'm waiting outside. My wife went to go run an errand and I had my son with me and we're on a tight schedule. So they got to get him to preschool after she gets on the bus. And we're standing out there, and it's fucking cold. And my son's a maniac. He's, like, running in the snow. He brings out his – he's super into the wrestling figures now. So he's got the old Hasbro ring that he just carries everywhere. And then he's got, like, four figures. You know, he wanted to bring the whole bag. He's got, like, 40 of them already. That just my old ones that I found that I keep
that
giving to him.
Bad.
Like, all my ones throughout the 2000s. So he comes out with, like, four or five of them, and he's being an asshole as usual. And the bus is just, like, not – the bus is just not showing up. And my neighbor's out there with his kids, and we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. And, like, he's, like, finally, like, all right, I'm going to take you guys to school. So I'm like, well, fuck, now I got to do the same thing because I don't want to be the idiot standing out here that his daughter's late. So now I got to go back. I got to go inside, get my wallet and keys, get his stuff ready in case I got to bring him right there. It's just, like, this clusterfuck of nonsense. And as soon as I get them strapped in the car – loaded up, I back out of the driveway, here comes the fucking bus. And the bus,
of course,
like a good 25 to 30 minutes late. And it turned out there was a social media threat made toward the middle school, and they locked down the middle school so the bus could not leave until they sorted things out. Now, I get it. That happens. It's not their fault. But in this day and age, in the year of 2018, nearly 2019, how is this system of public schools and buses so antiquated then I can't be alerted that the bus is going to be a half hour late? Like, don't you think there's got to be some kind of technology in place where I could track the location of the bus, or the bus, you know, we can sign up for a list and get texted from the bus, like, hey, the bus is 5 minutes out, you know, like, whatever. Like, like, how does this not exist in today's society? It's maddening. It's insane. It's like living in 1973, just standing out there waiting for this fucking bus to show up that could randomly come between any time between 8:15 and 8:22 as it is. Shows that up 8:45 today with no warning. It's just, it drove me nuts. It's like, what's the point? What is the point, Greg? What are we doing in this life that this is stuff that we got to deal with still?
These are the sort of questions that Earl Hebner was asking himself on Survivor or SummerSlam 2002. When he had his existential crisis in the Shawn Michaels Triple H match.
Why can't I? But even 2002, I get it, you know? Okay, back then, look how different things were. But look at the technology today. Like, I could literally program Scott's phone to let me know when he's taking a piss, and I could be not even with him, right? I can do anything. I can track anything I want these days. The NSA is probably listening to us right now.
Yeah, if you watch television, apparently, you know, all the comic book shows I watch, like, people can just type random numbers and letters on a keyboard and hack into the federal government database. So if that technology exists, why can't we appropriate it for usage in, you know, determining what the bus routes are, you know?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So that has started my day of bullshit. And it ended in a 120-degree fucking sauna of the pool at the YMCA that I was in for an hour and a half for swim lessons. That's another thing. Why is the pool so hot? Like, does it need to be that hot in there? Like, I was literally sweating just sitting there. That's how hot. It was like a sweat lodge.
Now, down here in the deep south, we've been told that up where you are, it is about 20 degrees year-round. So I could understand the hot pool, you know?
Yeah, but they don't air condition it in the summer. It's even hotter in the summer. It's absurd.
Can't help you there, sir.
What's wrong with this world?
Was there steam coming out of it? Was there steam, like, smoking out of the
out of my fucking ears? Yes, because I was so fucking aggravated.
See, down here, we don't even have heated pools. We just we don't even have technology, really.
You just have swimming holes.
Yeah, we just have swimming holes and outhouses. And
you know, we can usually tell by Chad's internet the kind of system you have down there. So
it's true. I mean, that's just how it goes. Hashtag Southern Internet.
Yeah, it's true. It's real. Southern Internet.
So
it's a thing.
Anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
But a great way to end the day, though, being here.
Hell yeah. Fucking dream.
All right. Now, normally, of course, the date is, by the way, November 24th, 1988. So almost to the day this year of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving this year is the 22nd. Saturday's the 24th.
Very
fun
good.
Day for
that's
us.
Impressive math right there.
There we go, right? Yeah. Hashtag use the phone. No. Anyway, September 24th, 1988, from the Coliseum, of course, in Richfield, Ohio, for the second straight year. Now, of course, there were no other shows on this day in the WWF. Everybody was in Richfield. However, what we usually do, of course, when we have a WWF pay-per-view, is to check and see what the competition's doing. Of course, the main competition at this point still was Jim Crockett Promotions in the NWA. WCW, the AWA was kind of still around, but of course, they were in the middle of their whole Kerry Von Erich Lawler thing going on in late 88. And the other promotions were pretty much toast by then. However, guys, there was actually a very memorable event that occurred on this date, November 24th, 1988, there was a taping. We got two things. There was an actual event at the Omni in Atlanta. Crockett had a house show. We'll get to the results in a second. But a very memorable TV moment occurred on an episode of Championship Wrestling, of course, which used to be taped from the TBS studios in Atlanta. I won't give you the jobber matches. But what happened on that episode was that was the episode when the Road Warriors attacked Dusty Rhodes and jabbed one of their spikes into his face, causing him to bleed profusely. Of course, TBS at the time was a little squeamish on broadcast television blood. They didn't really care about their pay-per-views. But they used, but of course, Dusty, you know, motherfucking gold standard, said, fuck that shit. And bled on broadcast TV. Well, Dusty was busted.
Dusty is busty.
That is true, so I wasn't wrong.
Dusty Rhodes.
Yes, Dusty was busted and booted as Booker, as TBS got almost 300 angry phone calls from TBS viewers saying it was a little too much for broadcast television. Yeah. Of course, as we know, Dusty would end up being fired later on down the line, but we'll get there. Anyway, on this evening, there was a big house show at the Omni on Thanksgiving. Here is your card. See if it matches up with you Southerners, Mr. Phillips. Tommy Rogers pinned Rip Morgan, already off to a great start. Mike Rotunda, your TV champion, and Dr. Death Steve Williams defeated Rick Steiner and Ron Simmons. Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose defeated Eddie Gilbert and the Italian Stallion. The Koloffs defeated the Russian Assassins in a chain match. Remember, the Russian Assassins were masked. Ivan and Nikita were actually babyfaces at this point. Dusty and a guy that we talked about earlier this year, JR, Bam Bam Bigelow, defeated the NWA World Heavyweight Champion.
Dusty and Bigelow teamed up?
Yes, they did.
All right. Have a good time.
That's right. Elections and everything. NWA World defeated the NWA World Champion Ric Flair and the U.S. Champion Barry Windham via disqualification. Of course, they were in the Horsemen. Mm-hmm. And your main event, Sting and Lex Luger fought the Road Warriors, who were your tag team champions, to a double countout. So probably not a bad house show.
No, that's a lot of star power.
That's it. They loaded there. Yeah. Loaded up.
If I had spending power at age four, I would have been there.
If only that was on CBS Sports Network, Scott could have watched it.
I could have watched it, yeah.
The only sporting events he sees.
Exactly. CBS. Yes, apparently. Never came up with that reasoning. Anyway, there you go. So the Omni in Atlanta that night while we are in Richfield, Ohio. By the way, if you want to follow along while you're listening, you can go to PleaseBeNation.com and find JR's and my Vintage Vault refresh of this show. If you need a date, it was October 30th, 2014.
You can just search it in the search bar. You don't want to go back through 4.5 years.
No, I didn't go back through all of it. I'm just saying.
That's 4.5 years of archives. Or you can go to the handy-dandy index page.
That's right. That's
someone we're tirelessly to create, and you can just search it. So there you go.
Oops. So there it is. So do you want to do the notes? Or you want to just dive in?
Yeah, no, we got a few here. Okay. All right. On the 11/5 episode of Superstars of Wrestling, the first Survivor Series report aired, which featured the announcement of all the matches. The original card, of course, we'll get to this, the replacements in a minute, but, so there you go. On the 11/19 Superstars, Brutus Beefcake defeated the Honky Tonk Man by disqualification at 158 when Ron Bass interfered as Beefcake had the sleeper on. Eventually, a brawl ensued between the Warrior, Beefcake, Blue Blazer, Jim Brunzel, and Sam Houston against Honky Bass, Danny Davis, Greg Valentine, and Ben News Brown. So, not too much build, but that's what we had called out in our notes. And that does bring us to Richfield for the second annual Survivor Series. Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura welcome us in. No Billy Graham, thankfully, after SummerSlam. He is not here. We have one sub here. So Don Morocco was originally on the face team of our opening match, and that match features the Blue Blazer, Brutus Beefcake, Jim Brunzel, who's replacing Don Morocco, Sam Houston, the Ultimate Warrior, taking on the Honky Tonk Man, Ron Bass, Dangerous Andy Davis, Bad News Brown, and Greg Valentine. So, here we go. Things start off hot. The Warriors team hitting the ring. The IC champ gets a big pop. Honky comes out with Jimmy and his squad, made up of a pretty good array of heels, and Danny Davis, who's still hanging on. Nice spot for Blazer, but bottom end of Warriors team is kind of rough. Brunzel's in his generic, awful tie-dye tights as the bees are no more. Beefcake's hair has gotten quite long and out of control here. Beefer and Hammer open up in a nice touch, and we get a solid quick back and forth till Davis comes in and gets a few kicks. Beefcake quickly gets a sleeper, and Davis is done, and he's just cooked overall. I mean, he's got nothing left in the tank, and Beefcake kind of officially finishes their issues off after he nearly murdered him on Saturday's main event back a few months back. Hammer comes in, works the leg. Beefcake fights it off and tags the Blazer. We get some tags and some arm work from the faces. Bad News gets a blind tag and batters Brunzell from corner to corner until he gets the Ghetto Blaster and elimination to even things up. Beefcake comes in and unloads to a pop, and Houston comes in and slugs away, but it runs into a hard boot. Bad News clubs Houston around, makes a tag, but Hammer hits him by accident, and the two start to shove. The rest of the team comes in to make peace. Bad News is pissed, and he walks out, getting counted out. Some nice character work with him. Hammer and Bass take turns beating on Houston some more, but Sam stays alive, hangs around until Bass blocks a monkey flip with a power slam to eliminate him. Warrior comes in, wrecks house, destroying Bass, Honky, and Hammer. The crowd's just gone bonkers here. Blazer tags in. Warrior sends him flying off the top onto Bass for two. Bass blind tags Honky, but Blazer gets a crossbody on him for two. Blazer outworks Honky for a bit, then he falls into the corner and tags Hammer. Blazer keeps control, picking apart the Hammer, looking pretty good. Honky knocks Blazer off the top. Hammer pounces, gets the figure four, and gives his team the advantage with the submission. Honky, Hammer, and Bass take turns pounding on Beefcake as they try and put him away. Beefcake blocks the shake, rattle, and roll, but he can't escape as Bass cuts him off. Beefcake mounts a comeback, rattling Honky with an atomic drop and hooks a sleeper. But Honky falls forward, and both guys tumble to the floor, and they brawl out there, where Beefcake gets the sleeper again, and that leads to a double countout. I thought that was a pretty good double elimination because Beefcake really can't take like another kind of lost, or not even lost, but just kind of a shit finish with Honky. And I do think Honky should have gotten pinned, but I get why they wanted to keep him strong, because I think he was still kind of doing the rematch stuff with Warrior. So they've been locked in a feud for about a year, these two guys. So it's fine to me that they both brawl to the floor. And obviously you wanted Warrior to stand alone, which we'll see in a minute. Hammer jumps Warrior, and him and Bass quick tag and double team to work over the champ. Warrior fights them both off, mows them down, takes Bass out, and then quickly finishes Hammer right after. Paint by numbers, nothing really stood out to me, but I thought Beefcake probably looked the best outside of Warrior. As far as overall presentation, Warrior wrecks shit and continues a super push. Fine opener, get the crowd kind of heated up with Warrior, but nothing overly memorable. I went 2.5 stars, Scott.
I gave this 3 stars. I'm probably going to overgrade a scoosh because I really, really love the show. I gave it 3 stars. I thought it was a lot of fun. Danny Davis is most definitely cooked. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I had no issue with Honky not getting pinned. He was okay for a little bit longer. We got to remember that Warrior's only been champ since August. So things are still relatively fresh. Obviously, we have a couple of MSG house shows left. So the loop is still pretty fresh. Obviously, once we get into 89, then Honky really starts to get fairly stale. You could argue right now that Beefcake and Warrior almost on equal footing. We've talked about since the beginning about Beefcake's evolution, and I really do think that he and Warrior could be on equal footing right now. I think either could be Intercontinental Champion and the other would still be just as popular. And there's a guy later on in the show that I feel is also at that level. I know, JR, we've talked the last few shows about kind of a dearth in the mid-card.
Yeah.
Now that we're looking, though, this is a big show to fix that. And as we can look ahead, this is a part of the roster that needed a little tweaking. One part of the roster that does need tweaking we'll get to in the next match. But the mid-card had some holes in it.
Yeah,
but I feel like now that we're going to flesh out some of the stiffs and really elevate, I think we're going to have a tight upper mid card as we get into 1989.
Yeah, I do. I can see the point with Beefcake and Warrior being even. I do think I would agree with that. I just think they're accelerating at much different speeds and they happen to just kind of cross here. Yes. Beefcake has like kind of slowly been moved up the ladder all year. And Warriors is like rocket push since SummerSlam. But yes, I would agree that right around this time, they're probably looked at fairly equally. I mean, Beefcake probably would be IC champion, right, if Warrior didn't get the spot. So I would think most fans probably see them on equal footing, but that's obviously going to end soon.
Yeah, and the speed of trajectory is very different. Beefcake, they've been pushing for over a year, whereas Warrior was, I don't know if he was last minute, but obviously he was not the first guy on the radar for Honky. And then when we saw what happened at the Garden in August, everything changed. But rest of the card was pretty standard. Blazer, you know, looking good in his quick time in the ring. And Jesse was very complimentary of him because we know who he is. And obviously Jesse thinks highly of his family. So he was going to put him over even though he's a babyface. It's one thing I always loved about Jesse. Other than that, pretty standard, Greg. 3 stars for me, but it was a lot of fun. I feel like all 4 matches didn't have any dead spots, believe it or not. Crowd was hot for the whole night. So even if there was I don't want to say dead, but a slow spot, the crowd really seemed into it anyway. Mm-hmm. Plenty of heels to boo, plenty of faces to cheer. So 3 stars for me in this first one, Greg.
Yeah, I'm gonna split the difference between you two and go 2.75, just to be different, I guess. But I did enjoy the pace of this one. I think it's, if I remember correctly, this was the shortest match of the night, I think. And it was, I thought a couple of things here. Jim Brunzell looked absolutely ridiculous. didn't look like he belonged at all. Like he had this horrible tie-dye job on his trunks. Although I give him credit because his name is Jumpin' Jim Brunzell, and the first movie he does in the match is jump. He does a leapfrog, and so I did appreciate that commitment to character. But Sam Houston didn't feel like he belonged to me. He took a hell of a beating. He didn't look bad out there, but I thought it was a clear difference in this match between the haves and the have-nots. Warrior, Beefcake, to a much lesser extent, Bad News Brown, Honky Tonk Man were the stars. Valentine was the mechanic, and everybody else was just kind of there. I mean, Blue Blazer had a good showing, I thought, but clearly wasn't a star on the level of his partners. Brunzell and Houston came off like big-time job guys. Ron Bass was done, I think, at this point, probably beyond done. Danny Davis, you guys already pointed out. And even Valentine was at the end of his rope as a single star. So I thought it was a pretty clear delineation of Beefcake and Warrior are stars, and we're going to put them over. And Bad News is going to be our next heel challenger for Macho Man, we hope. So they protected him in this one. So overall, fun match. Didn't overstay its welcome, which I appreciated. And did a good job of making Beefcake and Warrior look like studs.
I want to point out quick before we move on that I one thing I didn't mention. Glad, thank you for bringing it up, guys. Greg and Jay is Bad News. Because I know a lot of people probably thought that was a cop-out, but really, that was an expert booking decision for a character that would fit that. Like, that's not something you would normally see. They weren't big on that kind of thing with guys just, you know, leaving in the middle of matches and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was the modus operandi of the Bad News Brown gimmick that, you know, I don't believe in teams. I mean, seriously, I think – and we'll talk about it as we move ahead with his career here. I don't think we ever see Honky Bad News – in any tag match on the house shows or anything, I don't think.
They talk about that on commentary too at the beginning of the match where Gorilla says, I don't think I've ever seen him in a tag team situation. And Jesse says, nah, me either, basically.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that I don't think we're going to see it. And we're going to see house shows, which is usually, you know, sometimes you book a little differently when it's not a national national stage. And I think the same thing happens here. And so I just wanted to point that out that I thought that was an expert booking decision, just have him leave because this isn't his cup of tea, but you could not have him on the show because he's one of the hottest heels in the company right now.
Right. I didn't mind Honky not getting pinned because I think part of it had to do with there's no other way to get Beefcake out of there because they don't want Beefcake to get pinned. And they could have done the co-survivors, but I think they really wanted Warrior to stand alone to like look head and shoulders above everyone.
Right.
So I think that was the best way to take him out. The only other one you could have maybe done is have Hammer, since him and Beefcake have the real history with the Dream Team, and then just have Honky eat the last pin because Warriors, you know. But like I said, I think they're still – I don't know if they fight again on Science, but I think they're still trying to keep them at least paired together a little bit until they get Warriors' next guy ready. So it's clear that they don't want to completely burn Honky on 2 straight pay-per-views. But I think looking – if you want to look at it, I would have probably just protected Hammer a bit more since I think there's a little bit more juice in his tank, and you just have – Hammer and Beefcake reignite the Dream Team stuff, and then Warrior paste Honky one last time to end this match. Semantics.
I concur. Yeah.
Pituto. One great spot in the match, I thought, was I can't remember who it is that gets the hot tag and gives the atomic – the delayed – it might have been Warrior – gives the delayed atomic drop to Honky Tonk. I did appreciate Honky's selling of that, like bumping straight over the ropes on it. Pretty good stuff there.
Honky was – I mean, yes. That's his one – like the best part of his in-ring work to me is his over-the-top selling, and especially against a guy like Warrior who can just mow through him, and you see him, you know, flop all around and jiggle his legs and all this other stuff.
the ridiculous honky tonk man taunt that I used to do as a kid.
Yeah.
Not a good move, by the way, if you want to rise the social ranks of elementary school.
Yeah, it's clear you still haven't, but the honky, what a cliff. I feel like it was, what, about a year ago, Scott, right? We were kind of praising him in late 87 with the feud with Savage and the matches with Steamboat and everything else. And then here we are now. It's like, God. And we knew it was coming, but it really, once the 88 turned, he turned into the big old fat greasy pumpkin that he is.
Greased pumpkin. Did he ever wear orange tights? Probably not. Anyway. So here we go. Good opener with the mid-card guys. Excellent. But now, though.
Hey, PTB Nation. It is now time for the Rob Houston Memorial Hacksaw Jim Duggan update.
Vincent Kennedy McMahon Jr. here with your Rob Houston Memorial Fuckface Dipshit Derek Lewis, a piece of shit Jim Duggan update. November 1988, Duggan was lacing Rockin' Robin's turkey with some cocaine. How you fuckers doing? Chris Cole, you big giant fucking turkey, ready for Thanksgiving?
Vinnie Mac, how are you? What are you doing? Gonna sit at the head of the big family table with everybody?
I'm here with this fat turd Jim Ross. Didn't you see him sitting in your fucking corner sulking with his dumb hat on?
Now, Vince, that's not very nice of you to say, but I'm not gonna sit in the corner. I'm not gonna pout. That's not how Cowboy taught me. I'm gonna put on my boots one at a time. I'm gonna eat my chicken that you got here instead of turkey. I'm gonna put barbecue sauce on it like it needs to be, and I'm gonna kiss your ass, Vince. What would you like me to do?
I don't know who. Are you looking at me? Are you looking at Chris Cole? I can never tell what this idiot's looking at. I don't know. You know what he's saying? I don't understand the draw. There's a reason I kept taking him off commentary. God, you look like the fucking, who's a Rocky Dennis with that fucking face after you hit the cement?
No, Vince, I had a fall, I tripped, it happens, okay? Your ass tripped and blew out your quad, quite frankly.
I'm still standing! Yeah!
Listen here, Vince, I had Bell's palsy. Are you aware of what Bell's palsy is?
Is that the guy holding out for the Steelers that fucking Howard Finkel keeps talking about?
That's an embarrassment, quite frankly. He's put on his big boy britches, do the job that was to him, and let them perform fake colon surgery on him.
That's what I told Bret Hart. Just do the job like you're supposed to do.
Bret the Hitman Hart, one of the greatest of all time in this business. When you talk about telling a story, you got Shawn Michaels at the top, you got Bret Hart right there, then you got The Rock and Stone Cold. And Vince, who was it that signed The Rock and Stone Cold? Who was it that put together the greatest roster in the history of this business, some might say?
It's the best right-hand man I've ever had, Johnny fucking Ace.
Oh, that's real cute. Johnny Ace. Let me tell you about Johnny Ace. Johnny Ace has kissed so much ass that when they did a colon surgery on you, they found his ass.
You got a problem with kissing ass? Licking ass? Eating ass? What's wrong with you?
Well, I mean, I might have eaten an ass in my time. Put a little barbecue sauce on there, and anybody's ass will taste good.
All right, I remember one time. We finally agree on something.
I walked into the backstage area of the Mid-South Coliseum, and what did I see? I saw Hacksaw Butch Reed eating the Junkyard Dog's ass.
That's why I fired him.
Both of them, right?
Both of them.
They were just eating ass backstage, and I said to Cowboy, I said, by God, we got two wrestlers eating their asses backstage. They're supposed to be heels and baby faces. And Cowboy said, well, hell, son, that's how you get broken into this business. Next thing I know, he was eating my ass.
Well, I mean, look, you can't – I ended up having to sign the waiver. Jesse Ventura got all mad with the ass because he wasn't involved, and you wanted the fucking royalties and all this other shit. So then we had to fucking have the waiver. We had to have drug testing and then ass-eating testing. And then George Zahorian came around, and he was stabbing everyone's ass with his fucking needles. And then the whole thing just got out of control. And then I almost went to jail. All because of Butch Reed eating Junkyard Dog's ass.
Can I tell you, that's exactly what I'm saying, Vince. And while you are so eloquently stating that, I can't help but look over in this direction and see Scott Criscolo. Scott Criscolo,
look at him. He's a big stupid lump.
He's never contributed a goddamn thing to this business. He has never given an ounce of the sweat, the blood, and the by God mucus of Steve Austin. And I'm not going to stand for it, Vince. Why in the hell has he even been invited?
He's worthless. He's like a Thanksgiving turfucking. That's what he is. Just sitting there with his fucking thumb up his ass, waiting on Georgetown or whatever the fucking stupid school he talks about. Who got what? Criscolo, are you there? I was in the box with George Steinbrenner at Yankee Stadium. I didn't see you this weekend at the Notre Dame game.
Well, first off,
Boomer Sooner.
Too busy cooking the Eucharist at that church.
I can't believe that I'm on the phone right now, Vince. I don't know why Brad called me. I'm actually his boss. But anyway, he's telling me that we have issues now because you just made a Rocky Dennis reference. We could be sued for that.
Rocky Dennis?
How about a JR? How about a JR?
Isn't that the original concept behind Isaac Yankum? Rocky Dennis?
What happened to you, JR, when Lex Luger's contract expired? What happened there, huh?
We had a
when
handshake he walked out on Nitro. Agreement.
Was that Johnny Ace's fault?
We had a handshake agreement. Mistakes were made, and quite frankly, every human being makes a mistake. The challenge is to go out and do something nice for someone.
Yeah, wonder whose ass Lex Luger ate.
I made a mistake by not ejaculating my seed into the toilet instead of having my son Shane, that piece of shit.
Now, Shane has gotten us into some hot water over the years. I remember one time Shane was eating his own ass and actually dislocated 3 ribs in the process.
All right, that's enough. If you want more of this hijinks, Criscolo, you know, me and JR are putting on a Christmas spectacular this winter.
I know.
You going to be there?
Of course.
Oh, for God's sake.
Roll your ass down that hill.
Who's going to invite all the guests? It's going to be JR.
Get
how much work are you going to do?
Climb on his crooked back. Let him fucking hobble you over.
I'm just going to let it be known, Vince. The only caveat I have to this deal is Baker Mayfield has to be invited to this meal.
Baker Street. It's my favorite song.
Not a bad tune.
Mayfield? We're talking about the fucking pilgrims again? Sick of that shit. It's all I ever learned about in history class.
Jesse the Pilgrim Ventura was one of the great commentators in this business.
Oh,
I don't know
God.
Why.
All right, shut up. Armento, fire up Air Claire. We're out of here. You get fucked, Criscolo. All right, so we have a pretty big tag match coming up next, and there's a lot of moving pieces involved in this one. We obviously have seen the crux of the tag division has been built really around Demolition since WrestleMania, of course. But it's very clear, guys, that they were only going to be held down as heels for so long. Scott, we've talked about it a lot since April, where they're getting cheered more and more. Fuji is kind of, you know, we obviously seen that they can talk as well. They don't necessarily fit with Fuji. But as that's going on, we've also talked about is, and we talked about this real recently, I think, with Peter. Where is the depth of challengers for them as well? Because the Hart Foundation's kind of played out. They're in there with the Rougeaus, and Demolition's almost being used as like this catalyst in that feud. Whereas it feels like as champions, they should be doing a little bit more. Now, the Powers of Pain, of course, showed up in the summer, and that seemed like a natural collision course. And we'll see here that the Powers of Pain have been calling out Demolition, and they are lined up against each other in tonight's match, and that is the Powers of Pain, the Rockers, the British Bulldogs, the Hart Foundation, and the Young Stallions taking on Demolition, the Brainbusters, the Bolsheviks, the Fabulous Rougeaus, the Conquistadors, who one of these teams are not like the other. That is them. We do have a couple of debuts here, though, and that is the arrival of the Brainbusters, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. Martin Lundy was born September 20th, 1958 in Rome, Georgia. Of course, began his career in early 82, worked in Mid-South. By the middle of 83, he was in Southeastern Championship Wrestling, part of the NWA, worked his way up all the way to Jim Crockett's Mid-Atlantic, and due to his strong physical resemblance to Ole Anderson, they became brothers in kayfabe, the Anderson Brothers and Minnesota Wrecking Crew, they'd also be known as. Arn would replace Gene Anderson and take the name Arn Anderson. Arn and Ole defended the titles all throughout the year. The highest profile match would be at Starrcade 85. Defended titles against Wahoo McDaniel and Billy Jack Haynes. In the latter half of 85, they had started to become have a loose-knit alliance with Tully Blanchard and Ric Flair. And, of course, by early 86, Arn, in an infamous promo, would coin them the Four Horsemen, referencing the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Arn and Tully, who we'll talk about in a minute, would be two of the biggest stars in Crockett's company, but they were frequently in dispute over their pay. And, of course, as 88 was going on, Crockett was obviously facing a lot of financial issues, eventually would be bought by Ted Turner. But before that happened, Arn and Tully decided to jump to Stanford, where they felt they could be better paid and compensated. Their last match with the company took place on September 10th, where they lost the NWA Tag Team titles to the Midnight Express. Now, as I mentioned, his tag team partner, Tully Blanchard, born January 22nd, 1954, in Alberta, Canada, fucking too much Jersey Shore for me, as the son of wrestling promoter and AWA star Joe Blanchard. Tully was involved in professional wrestling from a very young age, selling programs, refreshments, on and on, attended the infamous West Texas State, played football as a quarterback and then a defensive end, along with Tito Santana and Ted DiBiase, trained by the recently departed Jose Lothario, Super Sock, debuted in 1975 in Southwest Championship Wrestling, feuded with Dory Funk and Terry Funk, along with his father, was South SCW television champion, heavyweight champion, and also teamed with Gino Hernandez. Came to Crockett in Mid-Atlantic in early 84. Got into a feud with Mark Youngblood over the TV title, which he'd eventually win in March of 84. Would face Ricky Steamboat at Starrcade that year and a lot of other contenders. In the mid-80s, Tully had a series of matches with Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico and then hired or took on Baby Doll as a manager, who he later fired in 1985. That kicked off a feud with Dusty Rhodes. And, of course, in all this, he also had a huge feud over the U.S. title with Magnum T.A., and that culminated in one of the greatest matches ever at Starrcade 85 in the I Quit steel cage match. And then from there, of course, he hooked up with Arn and became tag team champions before leaving here. And they arrived in WWF, and they were synced up with Bobby Heenan as the Brainbusters. So I'm going to take a breath. Greg, what did you think of them jumping ship, adding to the depth there? And did you think they were a quality pairing with Bobby, or did you find it kind of curious? Like, did they need a guy like Bobby to talk for them?
I think the first part of that question is, it was obviously a great signing, a great jump over, so to speak, for Tully and Arn to jump over. To be quite honest, going back and looking at some of the NWA shows around there, it would have been great for them to stick around, but they had really, who would they not feuded with at that point? It felt like they had wrestled everyone under the sun and every possible combination of Luger and Sting and Wyndham and all those guys. So to me, it felt like a great freshening up of both divisions in a way, sending them over to the WWF. And you guys were just talking about, and have been talking for a while about, the thinning herd in the tag team division. And I think they were instantly a great fit. I thought, you know, we'll talk about it in the match, but I thought they stood out amongst their teammates as particularly interesting performers, guys that were exciting to watch, could come in, could bring some actual good wrestling and good in-ring stuff to go along with the pizzazz of it. And I think pairing them with Bobby, while you might think, well, both Tully and Arn are great promos, obviously, but Bobby's the best promo, maybe of all time. And I think putting them with him also gave them the rub of the star power of Bobby Heenan, because I don't know that the WWF fans would have instantly viewed them as being important figures if they just immediately came in with no, you know, they don't have colorful gimmicks, they don't have, you know, over-the-top characters, so to speak, but when they first come in and they're just wrestlers, they may not have been able to get over the way that they needed them to get over right away unless they stuck them with Bobby, who can get anyone over.
Scott, how about you?
Oh, watching at the time, I was pumped because clearly two of my favorite guys at the time. Sad to see the Horsemen kind of break up a little bit, I guess, because, you know, 88 was such a year for them, because it was Arn, Tully, Rick, and Barry. So in-ring-wise, it was probably the best incarnation of the Four Horsemen. But they needed a change of scenery, and the WWF needed a heel team that wasn't a bunch either power guys or, you know, jobbing goofs. And they needed a good expert heel team in terms of in-ring, because the one team that was on the heel side doing that, the Hart Foundation, are now babyfaces. So they needed a good, work rate team to go on the heel side. Plus, I think Arn and Tully just needed a change of scenery. Obviously, they have issues with the Crockett family, and they always felt that, and they did always feel that they should have gotten, you know, Flair money, which is kind of silly, but
is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about the structure of it, Flair was, well, maybe
I think
at that
2 years
time,
earlier. In 86.
Yeah,
you could say, but by 88. They're pretty much a package, right? I mean, they're just probably as over, and they're a huge part of Flair's matches and everything else. I mean, I could see there them thinking they should at least be close to on par with Flair by 80.
Yeah, and plus at that point, the territories were dying out. So it's not like Flair was doing what he was doing like in 83, right. 84, 84, 85, where he was traveling to a zillion promotions and stuff. He was pretty much the Crockett guy, and that was it. So, all right, I could see that, I guess, now that I think about the timeline. But and as for Bobby, look, heels need managers. That's just how WWF works. That's how it's always worked. If you look back, if you watch like the old All-Star Wrestlings on the network, not one heel, even if it seemed like it made no sense, not one heel in the company didn't have a manager. Like nobody was on their own. Right. It was either Albano, the Grand Wizard, or Blassie. Mm-hmm. And every heel had, that's just the way WWF is. So they weren't going to come in managerless. And the one guy that fits with them, we talked about this with other teams, JR, in the past, about how certain types of heels match up with certain types of wrestlers. Fuji usually manages the weird kind of unique guys like Demolition at the time and like who he'll be managing soon. Jimmy Hart managed kind of the southern kind of arrogant, douchey guys. Valiant kind of – Johnny Valiant used to manage the trashy guys. Mm-hmm. Bobby managed like the guys that would fit in the family, kind of high-end, very slick, very cerebral. So – No one else would have fit with Arn and Tully other than Bobby. So
I think it has to do too with just getting them instantly respected, because I think they had plans to obviously put them in a prime position. So by putting with Bobby, it's like telling the fans that maybe not aware of them that they mean something important. Like right away, you're telling them like these guys are important enough to be with Bobby Heenan out of the gate. So I think lends a little bit of credence to them as well. So, all right. So big elevation here for Powers of Pain, aligned with Demolition as a top face team. Loaded teams up and down. Tag division is just off the charts depth-wise, out of nowhere. Nice reaction for Demolition. Rock stars at this point. Big pop for Powers of Pain, without the Baron, thankfully. The Stallions are still hanging on, the darlings of last year, if you recall. The Hearts and Bulldogs suddenly feel pretty dated, though. I thought the two of them felt shoved back in the division. When you look at some of these new teams popping up, we get the Rockers showing up, we get the Brainbusters, the Powers of Pain. All of a sudden, the Hearts, who've had a couple shots now and have lost, feel like they're in the back of the line, and the Bulldogs are even behind them, so... Both of those teams suddenly just feel way out of touch. Dynamite has a real weird mustache going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about that.
It's very wispy looking. It was odd. Dynamite and Jacques open up, lighting up that old feud. They quickly tag. We get Michaels and Nikolai and then Boris. The quick tags keep coming, and action is fast-paced, which excites the crowd. Jesse says the Rockers are always going to have issues with power teams, and we see it here as Axe batters Marty. We get our first sight of Arn, but it's fleeting as Marty rallies and knocks him back into a tag to Tully. Marty stays in control, taking on Jacques next before tagging in Dynamite. The tags keep coming. The near falls keep coming until Brett gets a small package on Ray to eliminate the Rougeaus, and that feud drives on, but I thought it was good to see the Hearts. It was kind of a good use here to have the Hearts do the deed. Even though it's a little surprising to see the Rougeaus go up first, the Hearts have kind of been outworked by them, both mentally and physically lately. So it was good to actually see them get one over on the Rougeaus in a clean setting where Jimmy and all the nonsense couldn't play a role. So I like that there. Mm-hmm. And it also gets over that anything can happen by having the Rougeaus go out first. We get some Haas power work between Anvil and Nikolai, and then Smash eats a hard clothesline. Barbarian tags into a Poppy, unloads on Smash, who quickly bails and tags one of the Conquistadors in. Barbarian cuts him down with a boot, tags Warlord, who beats on him in the corner. The Conquistador take a shit-kicking from everyone until he rolls away and tags Smash, barely surviving. Tully and Sean get a few seconds until Axe tags in, and the champs get to work clubbing away. Sean gets trapped in the corner, pounds on that, and then eats a hard boot from Arn for a near fall. Conquistador comes in and slams Sean too close to his corner. He tags Marty, who comes in hot. We get a bunch of tags and trading of offense that leads to a big Warlord-Axe showdown and a rowdy pop. Axe wins that, but Warlord cuts down Smash and tags in Barb, who lays in a hard back elbow and slugs away. The battles whose Demolition Powers of Pain are real hot. The crowd's real into them. Anvil gets a power slam on Tully for two. Dynamite comes in and clobbers him. The lariat gets slung to the floor. Dynamite gets worked on for a bit until he slips free and tags Powers. He gets a blind cross body, but Boris rolls through, gets a pin to even up the sides. Which is surprising to see the Bolsheviks with any kind of victory. Sean comes in and nearly puts Boris away, tags Barbarian, who shoulder blocks him right into a tag to Tully. Did you guys notice that a lot in this match, too? They seem to do a lot of, like, the guy inadvertently knocks his opponent into the corner. Did you happen to catch that?
Yes, repeatedly. Yes. Repeatedly. Yeah. It was almost to the point where I thought there were a couple of times during this match where there was a lot of repetition of spots, a lot. Mm-hmm. And that stood out to me to the point where even the commentators were openly mocking everyone for making rookie mistakes all the time.
Right.
In the match.
Yeah. You felt the same, Scott?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, with all those guys in the ring, they were good kind of tropes. I don't say tropes, but they were good chances to kind of
Yeah. But they kept going back to it. You know what I mean? Like, they just they could have found other ways. I just felt like they kept just leaning on, like, oh, he punches him and the guy flops into his corner. Like, they just did it a lot.
Right.
Tully comes in and struts over and tags Nikolai. That was real funny. I love that. So
that
I kind of cut that thought off. But so it was Barbarian gets tagged in. He shoulder blocks Boris into Tully. Tully tags, comes in, looks at Barbarian, just does this funny little quick strut over and tags Nikolai and then gets back out. And I thought it was funny because obviously, like we said, they're cerebral. They're smart, they're calculated, and it's a funny bit because it looks like a bit like a chicken shit. So the heels do what they can to work on Barbarian. They tag in and out, unload some heavy strikes. Barbarian fights off Nikolai, tags Sean, does what he can. Boris comes in, Marty gets a blind tag and a sunset flip, and that eliminates the Russians. Marty gets trapped and beaten on but escapes and tags as the match rolls on. Jesse notes that the tags are quicker now as the match goes on and the guys wear down. Tully reverses a whip that sends Davey hard to the corner and then gets to work. Conquistador comes in and fucks up and Davey escapes, like yet again. The Hearts work over the Conquistador. They have him dead to rights, but he somehow kicks out of the double team elbow. Conquistador keeps taking a shit kicking by various guys, surviving and kicking out of everything. Barbarian murders him, but knocks him backwards by accident yet again. And now he tags Tully to stay alive, and the crowd is all fired up for a Smash Barbarian battle, who as Smash gets attacked from Tully. We follow that with another flurry of tags, at least of the Busters going at it with the Heart Foundation, rotating through all the combinations. Brett and Tully battle in the corner until Brett hits a German into a bridge, but Tully gets a shoulder up and the Hearts are eliminated. Dynamite comes in and crushes Tully with an inverted pile driver as things devolve into a big brawl between the Brainbusters and the Rockers, leading to both teams getting disqualified after another ref comes in and can't get them apart. I thought that was a good way, again, to protect both teams, keep their feud going, because they're just kind of entering into one with each other. You didn't really want the Busters to lose here, and I think the same goes for the Rockers. So I liked that elimination. Did you guys feel the same?
Yeah, for sure. You got to keep them both protected and set up a string of some of the best tag matches the company had seen in a while. So, yeah, I definitely enjoyed that, even if the Hart Foundation elimination was a little unsatisfying, I thought.
Yeah, I think you feel that the Hearts definitely are taking a step back and letting some other teams get ahead of them. And I agree with Greg, and I know we'll document it, JR, but if the first babyface pairing for the Brainbusters for the next several months is the Rockers, you can sign me up any day.
Oh, yeah.
So it works for me. No problem at all.
One thing you pointed out, JR, is the the big moves that were kicked out of the double elbow from the Hart Foundation, the tombstone from or pile driver from Dynamite. Mm-hmm. It felt weird seeing so many big, powerful moves kicked out of, and then when you see some of the finishes through the result of the match,
clotheslines,
kind of odd, clotheslines and schoolboys and all that stuff.
Yeah, I would have liked I guess we'll talk about it in a minute, but I would have liked more if the Conquistador is like kept barely. Like, I didn't mind when they get knocked to the corner, like. Instead of them kicking out, they should have constantly been saved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone always comes in and breaks out the pin, or they get the foot on the rope, or there's confusion. I thought they actually legitimately kicked out of too many things.
Yeah, I agree with that. To the point that it was odd, especially, right. And we'll talk about it later, but it didn't feel like there was anything planned for the Conquistadors. They were almost being mocked by Gorilla and Jesse on commentary. Right. And they can't believe that they're staying in the match this long.
I almost wish, like, too bad they didn't have someone under the mask, and then they ripped the mask off after, like, show why they were so good or something. It's just such an anomaly, but that they're this good. It's weird. All right, so they're both gone. Things settle down with Smash and Dynamite going at it. The field is quickly thinned out. Good showing for the Bulldogs, I thought, too, to hang in on the waning days. I mean, they're just about done. The powers of pain of Bulldogs dominate the Conquistadors, but again, they can't finish them off. Jesse's shocked that the Conquistadors are still in there. Gorilla says he would have gone 40-1 odds on that. Jesse says calls Gorilla the Baron of Atlantic City. Things ebb and flow, along with the Conquistadors still living on. Davey rattles one with a power slam, doesn't cover, and he ends up escaping again. Like, that I didn't mind, right? Like, they're not covering, they're doing dumb things. Jesse shits all over Davey for that. The faces keep fucking around with the Conquistadors not covering. Jesse and Gorilla just keep calling him out on it. Conquistador dives and tags Smash as the crowd comes and goes throughout this epic match. And by epic, I just mean long. Dynamite whiffs on a top rope headbutt, and Smash levels him with a clothesline for the pin, leaving the powers of pain against two teams Conquistador has a brief glimmer, but the powers of pain decimate him until Warlord misses a charge and Axe gets the tag and gets back to work. And this is where I felt like things started to drag a bit too much. Like, I thought we were going to get into the finish, and here we are. The Conquistador is still fucking escaping and, you know, keep going on. So Conquistador has a brief glimmer. Warlord misses the charge. Axe gets the tag. The champs keep dominating. Fujin yanks the rope down on Smash as he hits the ropes and for some random reason. And that causes Smash to tumble out and get counted out. Axe gets in Fuji's face, but Fuji gives him some shit right back and jabs him and then smacks him with his cane. The champs have had enough with their manager. They slam him and then leave. The powers of pain then go outside and help Fuji up and bring him to the corner as Gorilla and Jesse are just completely lost in what's going on. As that plays out, the powers of pain come in and wreck the Conquistadors with an assist from Fuji and win to a huge pop. The crowd goes nuts when they win. And then they celebrate with Fuji. Demolition comes back out and they brawl. This was long, and at times it was intricate. It's a fun watch. It holds up. Lots going on. The pace was hot with tons of tags. Nice shine for majority of the teams. It was convoluted, but also memorable thanks to the storyline. We don't do quarter stars usually, Scott, so you have to either go like up or down. I went 4. I think mainly parts to do the storyline. I don't think it's as good or holds up as revered as like legend has it. I do think 87 is a touch better, but this definitely has the bigger storyline with the Powers of Pain Demolition stuff, which at the time, and we've seen play out, is a big deal, because Demolition has been on the precipice of being cheered for so long, and the Powers of Pain do seem better suited as heels, and with the Brainbusters debut and the Rockers, and it's like, there's a ton going on, so like I think that helps, but if you're looking at it from a pure match quality point of view, I do think it goes like, it's a bit long, it's a bit too long. Like, I wish they shaved a little bit of time off it. Like, it ends up going 40 minutes, which I think it could have been, like, probably taking 10 off of that. And I know they're trying to fill time, and they have this depth, but at some points it does seem meandering. So, Greg, I'll turn to you to start. I'm going to pause there. What are your thoughts on this match? Does it hold up to its legend, and how do you see it?
I got to say, I'm going to come off like the negative Nancy on this match, I can tell, because I can't go any higher than 2.5 on it me, because I really like, I felt every minute of this one. Like it's one of those long matches that, like I mentioned earlier, the repetition, I think for me, that's become, as I get older as a wrestling fan, more and more difficult for me to deal with some of the long matches where you see like a Flair match where you see the press slam called like 25 times in the match.
Right. Right.
And that's kind of how I felt watching this one, where I thought I thought the early part of the match was really good. The Rockers were great. I thought Marty Jannetty was Jannetty was the star of the match. He had some spectacular stuff in there, and Tully was great. But man, there were all the knockback into the corner, repeated kind of off balance clothesline spots where the guys kind of turn the wrong way at first, and he kind of bumps awkwardly, and a lot of like regrouping in the corner and. It didn't feel like it had much of a flow to it to me, and then it would have spots of really great, creative, cool stuff, and then spots of just dragging. And then to your point, when it came down to the powers of pain, I thought that was kind of a drag. And then especially the execution on the turn, I thought was really bad, because Fuji stands on the apron for what feels like an eternity, and then the audience, I don't think, is catching on to what's going on because they boo the big Demolition coming out and brawling and clearing the ring of the powers of pain. So I think the whole thing, as much as I wanted to like this match, because I remember liking it when I watched this on VHS as a kid, but it just didn't hold up for me. I just too long, I think.
I'm actually the complete opposite. I gave this 4.5. It took a lot for me to not make it 5, but it still holds up for me. There's just so much star talent in this match. It's nonstop action. The Conquistadors thing may be a little odd, but it doesn't faze me. It's kind of fun to add a little extra something to the match, and Jesse and Gorilla go along with it. I love that Jesse is so over with Arn and Tully. Like, he's so happy. One thing I love about Jesse is the kayfabe. He loses the kayfabe every once in a while, and you can tell that he's a personal huge fan of Arn and Tully. So. He puts that over big time. The commentary was great. The Fuji stuff was a little weird. I know they were kind of pigeoned in a corner because You don't know how to break Fuji away. Like, why would you dump your tag team champions for some other team?
I've never understood
Yeah, I never understood it either. Having said that, to me, it doesn't ruin the match. It actually adds some great intrigue, and I liked it. And I, you know, I love the fact that the announcers aren't stupid and didn't, oh, I don't know how this, why did this happen? Like, they're both like, yeah, something smells funny. Mm. I like that. I like the fact that they're not dumb, you know? And just everything was nonstop, back and forth. Bulldogs, everybody looked great. I mean, even the Stallions, they weren't in that long, but they look good. Mm. I don't know. I actually have to respectfully disagree, JR. I think it's better than 87. And I think the 87 match is fantastic. This one's still better. There's more star power. There's better talent.
See, I think the star power actually ends up hurting it in a way because you feel like
how so?
My standards are higher. You know what I mean? Like, you look at 87 and some of the teams in there, and, like, they almost overachieve. Whereas this one feels like, in a way, like they underachieved. Like, when you look at all the talent in there, it feels like it could have been a lot better.
I don't know. I think they went. I think they had their foot to the floor. I mean, I think the crowd. I think the Ridgefield crowd deserves a lot of credit. I mean, they didn't slow down once tonight, and I think that helps them. I think that the contrasting styles of ability. I mean, you're talking about 10 tag teams, and arguably probably all but one of them are probably going to be in most of our GWWE top, you know, tag team lists, and probably five of them will be in some people's top five in some order or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think they went as all out as they could. I mean, clearly Arn and Tully are not Johnny Come Lately. So yes, we talk about how the WWF style is different than Crockett, but they're not. I mean, these guys aren't, you know, rookies. So I think they settled in fine. I think that's why they hooked with the Rockers, because those are two guys that'll bump like fucking crazy for them. So I don't know. I still think it holds up as arguably one of the three greatest Survivor matches of all time. And I like the whole Fuji, and I think what does it for me there is Jesse. And if Jesse and Gorilla played it off like they had no idea what was going on, then yes. Then I would be like, all right, well, that didn't come off very well. But the fact that Jesse and Gorilla knew that who was in on it, and that this was more than just, you know, an overnight thing, actually made it acceptable for me. So I don't know. I'm watching it tonight today with the philosophy, JR, kind of how you're saying that, man, we've been gushing about this match for mm-hmm. 30 years, essence, and for me, I still do. It still holds up for me as arguably one of the two or three greatest Survivor matches of all time, and maybe top 20 greatest match in WWF history. Just so much talent, straight, and they're going crazy. And it just exemplifies the fact that we're heading into a golden 18 months of tremendous tag team wrestling that the company sorely needs. Finally, the mid-card, as we talked about earlier, is starting to work itself out. But this match is just incredible because all of the in-ring talent right now is in the tag division, and it showed in this match. It was the greatest example of one of the best tag divisions snapshot mm-hmm. in territory wrestling history. So it was hard for me to not give it 5 stars, but it wasn't 5-star level, but certainly almost there for me.
I'll never get Fuji's mentality in this. I mean, unless he was this. I guess what it boils down to is this: what he was like. He felt like Demolition was getting too big for their britches and kind of not crediting the master for
right.
taking
that's
them.
Right?
And that's basically what it boils down to.
Yeah. They were painted into a corner that logically they didn't know how to make any sense about it.
Do you think they should have it just be like Fuji cost them the belts, Powers of Pain win it, and Demolition gets it back at Mania? Like, do you think they should have done something like that? Like, instead of
probably
this, instead of doing it here. Maybe it's on TV or it's on Saturday's Main Event or something? Or do you think that you don't want to take the belts off Demolition? What do you think, Greg?
I don't know. I mean, that long title reign is so important to Demolition's legacy and what we remember them as that it's hard for me to imagine them having that broken up. But on the other hand, my memory as a kid, I only remember the Powers of Pain as heels after the turn. So I didn't remember them as faces. I always have assumed that they just weren't over. But judging by the reactions in this match, it seemed like they were pretty damn over, at least in front of this crowd.
They definitely were.
So kind of weird, I guess, to do a double turn in that situation, especially when, you know, they really didn't work as heels very well either. So, you know, it's kind of a weird situation to me. I think your scenario would make more sense logically, but on the other hand, I'd hate to lose the sheer length of the – you never want to lose length, first of all.
Never.
And certainly not when it comes to a tag team title reign.
And speaking of the tag teams and GW Tag Team Project, the ballots, as of right now, we're planning to close on December 31st. Be sure to check out Noah's Bar. Darren and I have been building our list, and you can hear if any of these teams are indeed in our top 10. But be sure to start working your list. If you have any questions about how to be involved in that, just let us know and get you added. So there you go. Make sure you get in the game. All right, so we're about halfway through. Why don't we go ahead and pause here? We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk some pop culture, and then we'll get through our last two matches and wrap up our Thanksgiving week episode here. So go catch a beverage. Go see what's going on in the football game. Go take a piss. Go get some quick head. Whatever you want to do. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Why is there a mask DVD sitting here?
Snowflakes start falling. That's when those blue memories start calling.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
PlaySweet Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaySweetNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PlaySweetNation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaySweetNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySweetNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySweetNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, this is Scott Keith, the former Net Cop, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
All right, Nation, we are back. Episode 505 of the Place to Be podcast. Greg Phillips, Scott Criscola, myself talking Survivor Series 1988. I've been sick for like a motherfucking week and a half. I took some, I don't even know what it was, cough syrup or whatever the other night, and it did nothing. And then I looked at the date, and of course it was expired. Like, does anyone ever have actual like cough medicine or other cold or flu therapies in their house that aren't expired? I feel like when you need it, you buy it, and then you use it once, and it just sits there and goes bad. You guys agree?
Oh yeah, that's every time you need it. Well, I have it and it sits there unopened. I have unopened things of like Advil or cough medicine or whatever that are like years out of date that I'll find. And I'll always think that I've thrown them all away, but no, never do.
It's
funny because expiration dates of medicine, it's not like milk. Like right. It takes a long time for medicine to go bad.
Right.
But it definitely just loses its effectiveness, right?
Well, and mentally, if you're at the store, if you're like me anyway, and you're a cheapskate, you're like, hey, I feel kind of sick. Oh, no, I'm sure I've got some of this at home. I'm not going to buy an unnecessary new bottle of, I don't know, bullshit and bring it home when I've got some at home. So
they need to make smaller sizes.
Yes.
If you just feel like you get like a two-day cold. I've always said that about hot dog buns and hamburger buns. I used to actually bring this up to my manager when I was at work to Stop and Shop like as a teenager. I'd be like, what if I just want, like, what if I'm just a single dude and I just want to make like two hamburgers? I got to buy eight or six. You know, it's like ridiculous. Yeah. Just make us a single man or single woman's hot dog or hamburger bun pack.
I just stopped cooking hamburgers when I was at the newspaper because I would never use all of the buns. And so it was like, well, you know, I'm not going to sit here with moldy damn buns in my cabinet. So I'm just done. I'm done. I'm out of the hamburger business.
Moldy buns.
You do it without the bun. Anyway, so I woke up the next day still coughing, and I'm like, shit, no wonder why I'm still coughing. I just drank a bunch of bad medicine. And speaking of bad medicine, that is the number one song in the nation tonight. That leads us in. You can hear it playing underneath us. Bon Jovi brings us into Scott Criscolo's Pop Culture Corner.
I wonder what bad medicine gets rid of delectable asses. Anyway, bad medicine is your number one song, yes. This is the Billboard list from November 19th, so the previous Saturday. Bad Medicine, Bon Jovi, from their awesome album New Jersey at number one. Number two, the previous week's number one, Wild Wild West by The Escape Club. At number three, Wild West, Kylie Minogue with The Locomotion. Desire by JR's favorite band, U2, at number four. Kokomo from JR's other favorite band, Beach Boys, from Cocktail at number five. Baby, I Love Your Way / Freebird Medley, Will to Power, remember them.
Good Lord.
George Michael, Kissing a Fool at number seven. How Can I Fall by Breathe at number eight. Look Away, one of my favorite songs. Look Away by Chicago at number nine. And at number 10, One Moment in Time, the Olympics song. I got it confused with the Final Four song. The Olympics song, One Moment in Time by Whitney Houston. So there's your top 10. That came out the previous Saturday, the 19th of November, 1988. And Bad Medicine by Bon Jovi is number one.
Fuck it.
Holiday weekend, JR. So a busy day in the theaters. Mm. Five movies came out. Let's buzz through them fast. The first one. First one. Movie is called Buster.
What was it you cut out?
Buster.
Buster. Okay. Buster Screen.
Right.
Buster Olney.
No, not Buster Olney.
Buster Film. Okay. Here we go. Buster Edwards, a petty criminal from the East End of 1963 London. His long-suffering wife, June, thinks of him as a lovable rogue. The film opens with Buster walking along his high school street. He breaks into a shop to steal a suit, into which he then changes to attend a funeral. Buster brings Harry, who's been used on other jobs and recently served 18 months in prison, to discuss his next job with the ringleader, Bruce Reynolds. I'm less interested in this. Starring Phil Collins, Julie Walters, Larry Lamb.
Holy shit.
Stephanie Lawrence, Ellie Beaven, Christopher Ellison, Martin Jarvis, Clive Wood, John Berard. If I can't get to the crux of the plot within the first couple of sentences, I just assume it's garbage.
That sounds like a giant turd.
So don't we all want to be called lovable rogues?
The soundtrack.
Craig Phillips, you're our lovable rogue.
The soundtrack have two singles from Collins, which topped the Billboard 100.
Oh.
Any guesses which two?
I'm gonna guess Against All Odds, maybe.
No, that was from 4 years earlier.
Shit.
Way too early.
You should know Scott, because I think it was number one recently for us on the...
Groovy Kind of Love?
Yep.
Yep. And In Too Deep?
Nope.
No, In Too Deep I think was Genesis.
Two Hearts.
Did you lose my number? No.
Two Hearts.
Two Hearts are beaming in just...
Isn't that the Nighthawk? Is that the Nighthawk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Has anyone ever referred to Phil Collins as a lovable rogue before that movie?
Probably not.
Or after.
Definitely
I think Vince
not.
Wants to be. VKM wants to be a lovable rogue. So, all right, number two, a great sequel. I'm sure we're going to get a Criscolo D'Amato joke in here somewhere. The sequel is Cocoon the Return. Okay. I didn't realize there was a sequel to this movie. But
5 years after they left, the Ant Terrians return to Earth to rescue cocoons that were left behind. Before they can be retrieved, one of the cocoons is discovered by a science research team and taken to a secure laboratory for testing. The aliens and human allies must find a way to retrieve it in time for their rendezvous with the rescue ship, while the humans traveling with them must decide whether to return to Antaria or stay on Earth and become mortal again. Starring Don Ameche, Wilford Brimley, Courtney Cox, Hume Cronin, Steve Guttenberg, Jessica Tandy, Martin Stapleton, Elaine Stritch, Clinton Howard. Pretty good crew. Brian Dennehy is a cameo as Walter.
It's a lot of old boners in that movie.
Courtney Cox.
That'll be cut in the new open.
Maureen Stapleton.
Finally got yourself in an open, Phillips. Nice job.
All right.
Old boner.
And it's talking about old men boners. Just like
see, now there's where I'll make the D'Amato and Criscolo joke. Not the old man boners.
All right. Number three. Oh, this is one of these. You want to talk about a movie that will bore you after five words? I can already tell by the description. Full Moon in Blue Water.
Okay. Sounds stupid.
It is.
Floyd owns a bar called the Blue Water Grill in a town of that name on an island off the Gulf Coast of Texas. He's lost interest in almost everything in the year since the mysterious disappearance of his wife, neglecting his business, staying home to watch old movies of his life. Floyd's father-in-law, known as the General, uses a wheelchair and trapped inside the throes of dementia. And whatever. Starring Gene Hackman, Terry Garr, Burgess Meredith. So pretty good crew there with those three. But clearly this was just a cash grab. I'm guessing by these folk made $450,000 at the box office.
All right. Next, we have a – I don't know what this is. Is this a war movie, I think? I believe it is. It is called Hannah's War. Hannah ends in an A, not an H. Hannah's War.
Okay. Hanna Senesch, the real-life Hungarian Jew who became a martyr to the cause of freedom during World War II through safely living in a British Mandate Palestine at the beginning of the war. Hanna volunteers to venture behind enemy lines in Europe, knowing that in all likelihood she will die. She's captured undergoing horrendous tortures before the Germans execute her. My God. Depressing Thanksgiving weekend movie here.
yes. Isn't that crazy?
Donald Pleasance. I don't really know anyone else in this thing. Anthony Andrews?
Ellen Burstyn. She's...
Yeah, okay.
She's pretty well known. Okay. And finally, this one is very well known, actually.
You think maybe she's going to escape or something in this? Like, no.
I know, no. No, it just ends dreadfully.
She is tortured and then she dies.
Horribly executed. All right. Okay.
The final one is definitely probably the highlight movie of the weekend.
Yeah.
It is actually this is a holiday movie because it kind of technically works with Christmas as well. So it fit for the season. The movie is Scrooged.
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest one.
Yes.
All right. IBC Television President Frank Cross, pushing his company to broadcast an extravagant live production of the Christmas Carol on Christmas Eve, makes his staff work through the holiday. Frank fires executive Elliot Loudermilk for disagreeing with him and sends cheap IBC monogram towels to all on his Christmas list, including his personal assistants Grace and his brother James. Frank's boss Preston Rhinelander sees the stress Frank is under with the production, brings in Bryce Cummings to provide assistance, and on and on. Starring Bill Murray, Karen Allen, John Forsythe, John Glover, Bobcat Goldthwait, Carol Kane, Robert Mitchum, Mabel King, Brian Doyle Murray. Cameos of Lee Majors, Miles Davis, Paul Schaefer, David Sanborn, John Houseman, Robert Goulet, Buddy Hackett, Mary Lou Retton, Jamie Farr, Larry Carlton, and Anna Ramsey. And I have a fun fact
cast.
For you. I would see this all the time in the, like, I was, whatever, 8 or 9. I would see this in the video store. And on the cover, it doesn't really look like Bill Murray. I always thought it was Brutus Beefcake.
Yes!
Yes!
Yes, thank you!
Doesn't it look like him? Looks like it, too. Yeah,
the hair and everything. Right? It's perfect. Like a little bit receding in the front and then mullet in the back.
I always thought it. I'd have to like double check every time I went through there. I'm like, is she just a Beefcake in this movie?
Hey, Sam Kinison's in that movie, right?
He's not listed on here.
Oh, well, never mind. Never mind. I must be misremembering.
No, I don't. You know, getting annoyed.
Maybe that's what happened. Is I confused the two of them. So yeah, isn't there a loud comedian in that movie?
Yeah. So it says this was pretty much just capitalizing on Ghostbusters. There's a lot of encounters with ghosts in the film and stuff.
Yeah, because Ghostbusters 2 had come out earlier in the year, I think, or maybe the year before.
No. Ghostbusters 2 is after this, I think. 89, right?
You think so? Maybe.
I feel like.
Anyway, there was your movies from the previous weekend. So
this it was the 13th highest grossing film of 88, so moderate box office hit at $60 million. Budget of 32, so made some money. Danny Elfman did the music, so there you go.
Yes, Danny Elfman, who would make an incredible soundtrack the following year.
Mm-hmm. Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
No. Well, maybe he did, but there was one that was even bigger.
I think he did Pee-wee, didn't he?
I think so.
Yeah. That was his first collab.
But,
with
Mr. Phillips, comic man, knows what movie I am speaking
of. Oh, yes, yes. You're referring, of course, you must be referring to My Left Foot.
Great comic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Stan Lee's masterpieces. Anyway,
Tim Burton's legendary classic. Yes,
of course. We'll get to that next year. All right. We go now from the screen.
Yeah, it's definitely Danny Elfman. Mm-hmm. The Overture from Rotella, as it's known as.
Yes. Now, we go from the big screen to the big field. Let's take it!
That is not the Fat Cat March.
Now, JR, you may actually get a chance here because, as Mr. Phillips mentioned earlier, we are in week 12 mm-hmm. of the 1988 NFL season. Greg was a mere 4. So, unlike our previous, your previous opponent so far this year who remembers these games.
Yeah, Greg, fucking Peter. I think he watched them all before we recorded.
We have Greg, who was drooling and shitting during these during these games.
And frankly,
well,
he still is right now.
I was going to say, he still too.
He does it right now. All right, so let's go
As
to week 12.
Nick at WrestleMania 32.
And every other WrestleMania he's attended.
I knew that was coming. All right, so right now, JR, I believe you are trailing by 3 coming into this week. Okay. So, all right, Greg, you got he's a champ, so you're gonna have to keep things going here. All right, we'll begin at the Astrodome in Houston, Texas.
The Astrodome.
The Astrodome, where the Oilers host the Phoenix Cardinals, JR.
I will take the Oilers at home.
Okay, Greg.
Oilers, because I do remember that the Cardinals were really crappy for a long time.
All right. Well, this was their first season in Phoenix. Warren Moon threw for 266. Oilers win 38-20.
Yeah.
A lot of low-scoring games this week. Let's go to the Homer Dome, otherwise known as the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome in Minneapolis. The Vikings and the Colts, Greg.
Oh my! Let me go with the Colts on that one.
JR?
I'll take the Vikings.
Just a reminder, Greg, Peyton Manning was not playing. Vikings win 12-3.
Ah, Jack Trudeau, right? Was the
I don't know who their quarterback was. Wade Wilson threw they did have Eric Dickerson, but
Jack Trudeau. These are Tecmo Bowl rosters. Original Tecmo Bowl rosters. 88. Yeah.
Yep.
Jack Trudeau was a diver, not a quarterback.
Let's go to Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City. The Chiefs hosting the Seahawks.
He wasn't even a diver, was he? What was I thinking of? The submarine guy that goes under
Jacques
the water.
Jacques Cousteau.
Yes, I know.
Jacques Trudeau. It's all the same.
I really fucked that joke up to the point where we had to explain all 3 layers of it. All right, what was the game?
We are in Arrowhead for the Chiefs and the Seahawks.
Chiefs at home, always.
Yeah. Greg?
Chiefs as well.
And they do indeed win, 27-24. Let's go to Lambeau Field in Green Bay, the Packers hosting the Lions. Greg?
Ooh. I'll go – I think both teams were pretty not good at that time, but I'll go with the Pack.
I'll go with Jared. Detroit.
Don Majkowski threw for 327 yards, but the
Magic
Lions
man.
Win on the road, 19-9. This was Jay, by the way, Greg, Barry Sanders' senior year at Oklahoma State. He was not a Lion yet. So
why did they call Don Majkowski the Magic Man if he never won?
Because his name had M-A-J in it, and that's how.
Okay. It's kind of like a Fitzpatrick thing where he never wins, exactly. But he gets a nickname.
Yeah.
I got you.
All right. Let's go to the Hole in the Roof, Texas Stadium in Irving. The Cowboys host Cincinnati. JR.
I'll take the Bungles. Andy Dalton has a day.
Yeah, I'll take Boomer and his crew by 30.
Yes. Well, it wasn't by 30, but the Cowboys were fairly bad that year. Boomer did play well, and the Bengals win 38-24. Let's go down to the Big Sombrero in Tampa, the Bucks hosting Chicago. Greg.
Now, this has to be the Bucks. The Bears, sorry. The Bucks were
you
horrendous.
You said Bucks. You said Bucks.
The Bucks were horrendous for a decade, so yes.
Yeah, I'll take the Bears.
Bears win 27-15. Let's go to Cleveland, an annual war, or one of their two annual wars, between the Browns and the Steelers. JR.
I'll take Cleveland.
Had to be Cleveland. The Steelers sucked at that time.
And Cleveland was exceptionally good. And the Browns win 27-7. A barn burner in Orchard Park, Rich Stadium in Buffalo. The Jets, 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 Jets taking on the Bills, Greg.
Jim Kelly and crew. Bills.
Yeah, I'll go Buffalo at home.
A barn burner in Buffalo. The Bills win in overtime 9-6.
Awful.
Big fantasy day. Let's go to Giant Stadium in the Meadowlands. The Giants host the Eagles. JR.
I'll take the Gents.
I'll take the Eagles.
Eagles win in overtime, 23-17. Let's go to the Superdome in New Orleans. The Saints hosting Denver. Greg.
Oh, my gosh. That's a tough one right now. I think this is one of the rare years where the Saints were good, so I'm gonna take the Saints at home.
I'll take Elway on the road.
Well, the Broncos were having a tremendous season. Saints win 42-0.
Jesus.
Whoa!
I gotta check. Before we go any further, I have to check the line score.
There's no way Elway was not a player or something.
Did the Broncos think it was the Super Bowl or something?
They would eventually. No. Did Elway even play?
He must not have.
18 of 36 for 166 yards, no touchdowns and a pick. But Kubiak took some snaps. So maybe Elway got hurt. I don't know. But
Elway had some games like this. I was a huge John Elway fan, and he would always be good for like one or two of these games a year where he would just, not even show up. Mm. Yeah.
Let's go to Anaheim as the Rams host the San Diego Chargers. JR.
I'll take the Rams.
Rams for me as well.
Jim Everett threw for 243, but the Chargers win on the road, 38-24. Let's go to the Mausoleum in Los Angeles where the Raiders host the Atlanta Falcons, Mr. Phillips.
Raiders.
Yeah, I'll take the Raiders in the hole.
Steve Berline, buck 82. But another low-scoring defensive fistfight. Falcons win, 12-6. Oh,
wow. Oh, how long was Steve Berline in the league? My God.
Man. He's like a 96 still, right? 97?
Yeah. He was like a grizzled veteran when I was like 7.
Wasn't he like one of the first Panther quarterbacks, I think?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
So anyway, if you pick the over in any of the games this week, you were fucked. Hmm. Let's go to Miami, where, speaking of a guy you mentioned earlier, Greg, Dan Marino and the Dolphins hosting the New England Patriots. JR.
Miami.
So I know the Fins. I think the Fins only won 6 games this year, but I'm picking them because they own the Patriots' asses when I was a kid. So,
well, on this day, the Patriots ate the Dolphins' asses.
Damn it!
6-3.
Ugh. God damn it! Give me the stat line for Dan in that game.
Let me see what Dan had in this game.
He saw, I shit the bed and figured he had a match him.
Let's see. Pats were 7-5 at this point. Elway, Marino was 19 of 29 for 169 yards. No touchdowns.
Almost the same as Elway.
Yeah.
I mean, Doug Flutie was 9 of 13 for 78 yards. I don't know how the Pats even won this game. Ugh. And finally, on Monday night, from the stick, the 49ers host the Washington Redskins, Greg.
Niners.
Yeah.
Niners win 37-21.
Wow.
Can I just make a comment? It seems like 1988 NFL sucks from everything you're saying.
There's been some decent games, but this week was terrible.
Yeah, no, this week there was just no – yeah, there was just no offense on this week. But, no, 88 was good. It was a pretty good
game. All right, so we went 9-9. Wasted opportunity by me. I had a 2-game lead at one point in the middle there. But so let's say I still remain down 3 on the year, so evened out with Greg.
All right. In the NHL on this night, just 3 games. Bruins did win in overtime, 2-1 over the Flyers. And a quick check of the National Basketball Association. I'm curious because back in those days, I wonder if the NBA took Thanksgiving Day, but curious to see. Let's take a peek and check who was let's see who was on the hardwood on this day. Greg, were you a Hawks fan in your formative years?
Oh, no. I didn't even pay attention to the NBA until I was in middle or high school, and then I selected the Utah Jazz as my team.
Okay. Well, the NBA was off on this Well, it was Thanksgiving, so yes, mm-hmm. they were off on that day, mm-hmm. and the Jazz were actually. The Jazz are actually 7-2 to start the season. There you go.
Oh.
All right. So there is your pop culture corner. And back to Richfield, Ohio, JR.
All right. That's where we go. As Sean Mooney is with Bad News Brown. He calls them an independent soul, which is a nice way to say you're an asshole. Bad News says there was a conspiracy and he was attacked by his own teammate out there. Everyone wants to be the first person to beat him. The only thing he cares about is the WWF title. He deserves it because he won at WrestleMania and has beaten everyone else in his way. He says Jack Tunney's ducking him. And he'll soon he will find him soon and demand answers. Bad News bags on Miss Elizabeth and says he needs nobody. Gene's with him with the powers of pain and Mr. Fuji, who says Demolition's heads got too big. They thought they knew more than the master. Him and the powers will make them suffer. Barbarian says Demolition has lost Fuji and they will lose their titles. Gene is then with Andre the Giant and their team. Bobby Heenan says soon Andre's hands will be squeezing Jake Roberts' neck as he hides behind his teammates. Bravo says he's coming for Duggan. He'll humiliate him in All Americans. Rude, Perfect, and Race all brag from there. Sean Mooney then is with the Mega Powers and their team. They're ranting and raving, and they're set to take out the Twin Towers and their crew. Hogan says they're all united and feel sorry for their opponents tonight. That brings us to our next match featuring co-captains Andre the Giant and Jake the Snake Roberts. And on their team, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to check this. They're feuding. Co-captains Andre the Giant and was it Dino Bravo the other co-captain?
Canadian Strongman, yeah, Dino Bravo.
Bravo was.
Teaming with Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, and Harley Race, taking on co-captains Jake Roberts and Jim Duggan, and then Ken Patera, Scott Casey, and Tito Santana, which we'll talk about in a minute. We didn't mention that earlier, that each team had co-captains, not just captains this year. So in the opener was Ultimate Warrior and Beefcake against Honky and Bass, and then Powers of Pain and Demolition with the co-captains, and now Andre and Dino versus Jake and Duggan. The captain's there. So Mr. Perfect, I mentioned his nickname there. It was during this time period, he was now known as Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig. Still wearing the black tights, still using the Kurt Hennig. But vignettes had begun appearing over the past several weeks with Hennig playing basketball, golf, chess, darts, and shooting pool to show that he's perfect in all sports endeavors. So there you go with that. So we do also have a replacement in this match, and it's actually a double replacement. Scott Casey replacing Brian Blair, who's replacing the Junkyard Dog. JYD is originally part of this team, kind of playing off the end of the Rude JYD match at SummerSlam, but the Dog left before this match. It was then decided that Brian Blair would replace him, but he was, you know, reportedly pissed off that the Killer Bees had been broken up and kind of saw where things were headed. He bolted, and Scott Casey was drafted onto the pay-per-view. So, I don't know, I guess a notch above jobber level for Scott Casey. We've seen him actually win a match or two at MSG, so anyway, decent there. Face team's a mishmash of randomness. Casey gets his big payday. Patera's still hanging on. I thought it was good to see Harley back on his loaded team of nasty heels as well, and Bravo. But I like to see Harley back in action. He, you know, recovering from the injury, kind of lost the King gimmick, so you're wondering what's there for him. So it was cool to see him out there. Race and Perfect in the generic pay-per-view shirts always make me laugh as well. Great presence by Andre. Patera's hair has somehow gotten worse than it has been. I don't know how. It's like he went in and said, like, can you make me even uglier, please?
The most frightening thing is the still image of him before the match. It's just, it's hysterical if you guys remember it. It's phenomenal.
He needs to do something. All right, so he opens up with Rude. That's brief. The heels start quick tagging. They work Ken's arm until Ken shoves Perfect to the corner, tags Jake to a pop. The faces work in and out, working on Headache's arm. Nice spot for Headache here to elevate and get showcased against some upper-level talent. Speaking of, here comes Scott Casey. He gets a tag, gets a flurry. Bravo cuts him down, and Ray, still in his King tights, hits a nice gut-wrench suplex. The heels batter Casey, but he eventually escapes. Duggan makes his first appearance to a big pop, and he smacks Perfect around. Gorilla plugs the Royal Rumble as Rude batters Casey. Tito tags in, gets two on the forearm. Duggan tags and unloads, but whiffs on an elbow. We get a collision. Patera works over Rude, but eats a boot on a charge. Rude gets a awakening, and that ends Patera's run. Harley beats on Casey after that, as Gorilla wonders why where Harley got his tattoos, and Jesse says maybe he was in the Navy. Bravo comes in and plants Casey with a side suplex to take him out. Tito comes in hot, gets a showdown with Perfect, and tags Duggan, who gets caught and leveled by Andre in the corner. Duggan's overwhelmed by the numbers, but battles Rude and hits him with a hard clothesline. Bravo and Tito end up together, with Tito getting a crossbody for two, but Dino takes over. Harley stuffs Tito with a nice pile driver, but only gets two. Tito recovers and gets a desperation forearm to eliminate Harley. Andre comes in and slugs away with heavy blows, chokes, and then sits down hard on Tito's chest over and over. Andre's just a monster in there, just destroying Tito as he blocks a sunset flip and slams down on his chest one more time to get the pin. Duggan comes in from there and clobbers Andre, who falls back and gets tied on the ropes, and the crowd just goes crazy. Great spot. Duggan and Jake hammer away at Andre and the whole team as the crowd is all fired up. And this was actually Jake's first time in the ring, which I found interesting. He'd been on the apron the whole time till now. Andre gets loose and tags to Rude, who ignites his old issue with the snake. The heels rotate, beating on Jake, but he eventually punches back against Bravo as the crowd is just willing him on. Rude drills him for the apron and tags in and works over his nemesis. Jake eventually escapes. Bravo tags out as Hacksaw comes in and runs through him. Frenchie yanks Duggan to the floor, and Bravo comes out and slams him down. Duggan grabs a 2x4, cracks Dino with it, and gets disqualified. We reset a bit as the heels talk strategy while Jake rallies the crowd. Jake hammers away at Perfect and then gets a deal with Bravo. Gorilla says waving the flag is the only thing that Frenchie is good for, and I agree. He's fucking worthless. Bravo whiffs on an elbow and tags Rude, but Jake hits the deck to regroup. Jesse tells him to take a walk and call it a day, but he does not. Rude goes to the eyes and controls for a bit, mixing in some taunting as Jesse says Cheryl's going to go with the winner here. Rude tries to tag, but Jake yanks him back and snaps off a DDT to eliminate him and really put the punctuation mark on their feud. Andre comes right back in again and chokes and chops viciously, even biting Jake. And then Andre keeps choking until he gets disqualified. A real nasty assault that's filled with rage. You can tell he's pissed over the snake stuff. Andre drops Jake with a headbutt. Perfect just slides in and covers him for the win. As worthless as Bravo is, I thought his celebration was pretty funny here. He did nothing. Just came in and went crazy. Really fun match. I like the story that was told where Andre's just this vicious monster getting revenge on Jake, murdering Tito. And I thought Perfect looked real good, too, in his showcase. The face seems kind of a mess outside of Tito and Duggan. And this was fun. The crowd was engaged. And again, Andre's been the MVP for me for 88, and he showed up again here just looking like a beast. I went 3 stars on this. I think it's a bit of a little borderline hidden gem on this show. What do you think, Scott?
I gave it 3 stars as well. And I have a feeling we'll be giving, when we get to the awards later, I think we're going to be giving Andre some more accolades because he was fucking awesome in this match. Dino Bravo is just a useless fucking lump. He brings nothing to
any celebration tables. Might be the greatest thing he's ever done, and that's it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. His celebration worked great, particularly when he didn't fucking do anything about it. Is
perfect.
Even better.
Sums up Bravo. Does nothing and celebrates.
Yeah. And I of course it's one thing that's always said about this Survivor team. It's kind of sad that the oldest guy on the team is the only one still alive, and that includes one of the managers. Mm-hmm. So. But anyway, it was a great match, just back and forth. I enjoyed. I mean, this babyface team. I mean, Jake is solid, but the rest of his team is a little noof. Scott Casey obviously is just a stand-in. By the way, incidentally, we were talking about replacements and stuff. According to Graham at thehistoryofwwe.com, our previous match was actually the British Bulldogs' last match. That was it after this.
Oh, okay. For them. I was going to mention too. This is Ken Patera's last match. So he's scheduled for one more match in December. He gets replaced and he's done. So why don't we talk about the match?
The creamy thighs are gone.
He's gone.
Creamy thighs are gone.
Talk about the match for a second, Scott, and then we can talk about those two folks departing.
Yep, absolutely. The match was great. I loved it. It was really good. And Andre is just an animal. He's so good. He's just putting over himself and putting over himself as a heel, but he's putting over the storyline. He's putting over Jake. I mean, the choking was just awesome. It was just awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was going to rip Jake's head off. I mean, it was tremendous. I think the more we watch it, the more we've watched him, JR, the more that Andre realizes his limitations as time has progressed and what he still can do well, he does to the nth degree for himself, for the company, and for his opponents. JR is just JR. Well, JR, you. Andre is the perfect company guy right now. He's just doing everything that's needed of him and doing it well. Now, we were talking about – I mentioned earlier about Beefcake and Warrior at that level. And begrudgingly, I have to give Duggan his due. He's at that over level too. I mean, he's obviously, to me, less talented than the other two. But he is just as over. They kind of dig this, big, goofy, dopey buffoon, and that's fine. But obviously you have an immense amount of talent on this heel team that just has yet to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect, Rude. But obviously the next 2 years, we will really see these guys reach their peak. Right now, they're still a little, you know, they're still getting their feet. Rude at this point is ready to bust out, I think. But Perfect, already we know, is an exemplary wrestler. He's just trying to get himself intricated on what to do with, you know, in his next role. Tito is kind of like Valentine now, like you were saying earlier, Greg, about Hammer. Tito's pretty much in that same boat. He's, you know, pretty much just the guy, that guy there, you know. Same thing. Good match overall, but, and we'll get more into it during the awards, but Andre is just on fire still. I mean, he could easily be an MVP of 1988 if we really talked about it, because he's just been amazing, Greg.
Yeah, and it's especially amazing if you take into account the amount of pain that he was in at this time. Yep. The fact that by all accounts he was, you know, on his last legs and yet was still going out there. And I agree with you guys. He was spectacular here. Like, I also love the way the ring was mic'd at this show. Everything sounded so devastating. All of his chops, his mm-hmm. slaps, his strikes, they sounded absolutely devastating to anybody he touched. And I'm in a pretty good place with this match. I went 3.5 on it. I really enjoyed the entire storytelling of this. And that's giving it a handicap of Scott Casey, who I've never I have no memory of this person existing in my lifetime. I don't have any memory of Scott Casey as a human being, much less a wrestler.
The good thing is he doesn't remember you either. So
that you know of. I mean, we may have had some chance encounter I've checked. I'm not aware
I've
of,
checked.
But he's here and he serves his role, I guess. And then but everybody's good. Like, the Rude and Perfect are really good at playing the young cocky heels. Perfect does a lot of the heavy lifting early on in the match and looked really good doing it. I say everybody's good. Obviously Dino Bravo is not good at anything except the celebration. Harley looks better here than he did at times. You know, he's moving around pretty good and has a nice little suplex thrown in there. Patera, I have no time for, but again, serves his role here. And mainly, this is just a storytelling match. They're setting up the story of when Andre's going to get in the match, and when he does, he wrecks shop. And he, you know, Jake puts up a gallant effort to stay in the match, but, you know, I thought it made Jake look like $1 million. I thought it made Andre look like $1 million. It made me want to see them wrestle each other, which I think was the idea. Duggan is protected really solidly, and in typical Duggan fashion, gets himself disqualified because he's not the smartest guy in the world. But yeah, I really enjoyed this one, guys. This one moved again, even though it was 30, you know, a half hour long roughly. It moved at a really good clip for my taste anyway.
All right. No, I agree. I agree with a lot of what you said, Greg. And like I said, in my thoughts too, it's almost like I think it's a hidden gem on this card. For sure.
It is.
Yeah. All right. So here's Ken Patera's final days. He obviously left after the show. He went to the AWA and hung out there for most of 89, feuding with a bunch of different people, had a little run with Larry Zbyszko with the AWA world title. Left AWA, went back in early 90, stayed there till it collapsed. Then he worked for UWF and PWA, worked in Minnesota area until into the 90s, even promoted his own events. It looks like his final match perhaps was on August 12, 2011, at a Juggalo Championship Wrestling Legends and Icons event. He faced Bob Backlund. So that's it. And most recently popped up in the news of wrestling as part of that class action lawsuit in 2016 over the brain injuries. That was, of course, dismissed a few months ago. So,
that's why his hair grew so strange in 1980.
Covered up the brain damage. Yes.
Brain damage hair.
So, pretty quiet vanishing for Kenny, who's been a bit of a revelation for us here in '88. I've enjoyed him. I'm gonna miss him a little. I mean, it's time for him to go. I've enjoyed his energy as the, you know, Jobber to the Stars veteran who's got like a ton of energy and flying around out there. So I will miss him on that level. Like you said, Scott, it's also the final match for the British Bulldogs, who show up here. They have a good little showing. And of course they would left after all the events leading up with the pranks and the altercations. I think everything kind of finally added up, even though Tom Billington, Donald McKidd, claimed that the Rougeau incident was not the final straw that made him leave. He said it was a dispute over complimentary plane tickets. He resigned And he was actually surprised looking back that Davey Boy followed him. He thought Davey Boy would have stuck around. So they would leave to go to Stampede and then All Japan. They'd eventually, of course, have a falling out. They would wrestle each other. Dynamite would go heel. They'd feud for a while. And then Davey would later, if you believe Dynamite, kind of stab him in the back and get a wink-wink deal with the WWE. You have to go back as a singles. And they had their issues from there as well. So in September 90, Davey Boy abruptly withdrew the Bulldogs from the AJPW Annual World Strongest Tag Determination League by returning to WWF and fabricating to the All Japan office that Dynamite had been in a serious accident. Davey Boy had trademarked the term British Bulldog during the previous run, and when he returned as a British Bulldog, he would send people to United Kingdom to warn the promoter every time a flyer distributed promoting Dynamite Kid as a British Bulldog. And Dynamite would despise Davey for a long time. So there you go. Issues for them. Dynamite we will not see again. Davey, of course, will be back for us. Any final thoughts on Patera, the Bulldogs, Greg?
Yeah, I remember Ken Patera when I was a kid as just that old dude that I wished would go away. And you know, I'm sure I mentioned how he would hold up revisiting his stuff. But, yeah, Patera was not missed. The Bulldogs were missed. They were one of the first acts that I remember in the WWF really catching on with me. Like, obviously, I loved Hogan and the Warrior and, you know, Tito. But yeah, the Bulldogs were a huge deal. And I noticed on this show there were people that still had Bulldogs merchandise in the crowd. There's a kid in the front row that keeps holding up a Union Jack during the match. And so – I mean, you guys have been following it more closely of 1988. Did they still have any juice left as an act? Because it felt like they were still pretty over.
Yeah, they were over. We saw them win a decent little feud with Demolition over the summer. Like, that wasn't bad. They had the stuff with the Islanders earlier in the year. I think they should have tried them as heels, honestly, because if you look at the heel side, and we saw it earlier in that tag match, I mean, I guess you get the Busters now, and you got the Powers of Pain. But there's a little bit of lack of depth on that side with the Bolsheviks, you know, and filling out that side with the Conquistadors. So, like, the Bulldogs' own heel might have added a little bit of extra depth. Now, we'll see, you know, another team later on tonight, and things are filling out a bit more as we go in. They'll combine some other folks as teams. But I think they should have maybe just given them a shot as heels and to see if they had anything in the tank. But I think Dynamite was a powder keg that was going to explode at any time. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. I think the thing that surprised me the most in the Bulldogs in the show is that Dynamite didn't look as bad as I expected him to look. Because, you know, you think of Dynamite post-injury as not being close to the same guy. And he's not, but he looked pretty good in the match earlier. But then, you know, you factor in his backstage behavior and you factor in the fact that Davey looked like a friggin' $1 million, right. A roided up $1 million. I guess it's clear that one of them was going to go on to stardom and the other one was – on the decline.
And he has looked better in 88. A lot of his issues are more in 87, where he was like standing on the apron during tag matches and stuff. But in 88, he's almost had a little bit of a bounce, a dead cat bounce in a way, where he's, I don't know if the back is just feeling better, if he was just really loaded up on, you know, doped up and shit. But he's been moving better in 88. Not as good as he was like in 86 when he was real crisp. But anything, Scott, on the Bulldogs or Patera?
Well, I will say this about Patera. The new, you know, since we've done the refresh and we've actually watched stuff in between the pay-per-views, I've definitely gained a new appreciation for him because he definitely worked his tail off. He wasn't lazy and he didn't put on bad matches, but when he worked really hard and, you know, did what he had to do, put guys over when he had to put them over. So I did gain a new respect for him. He did still look weird with his shaved legs and his weird hair and his, you know, that weird cyborg arm thing he used to wear. But anyway, I thought he was fine. He definitely was a lot better than I remember him being. And I think watching like the house shows and the stuff that we haven't seen really changed my opinion of him. As for the Bulldogs, I think I agree with you, JR. I think that regardless of what we were going to gain from a heel turn, I think Dynamite's fuse was just so short that I don't think he was ready to work with anybody. I could just see a Bulldogs like, well, they would have been on. Let's just say that Bulldogs and Brainbusters wrestled as faces heels thing, and you know, Arn or Tully does something, and fucking Dynamite snaps, and we start getting shoot moves, and I have a feeling that Dynamite was on the verge of like losing his shit. So. Mm-hmm. probably from a business perspective, it was better off they left.
Yeah.
If everything was fine, then yeah, I think turning him heel would have been a fine idea. Mm-hmm. Could have made him like, you know, start bashing Americans and hooked up with the Rougeaus. It could have been like with Jimmy Hart, make like a little anti-American faction or some kind of nonsense.
Yeah. The inverted Hart Foundation Bulldogs feud would have been fun.
Yes, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But in a bit, from a business perspective, I think Dynamite needed to leave.
Yeah, and it's also a time we're seeing a lot of guys get purged. Like, it's also a purge. Like,
right.
We're really turning over the roster now. Morocco's going, Patera's going, the Bulldogs are going. You know, like, we're starting to see guys that have been just hanging around for a while really starting to kind of be purged, and we're seeing a new influx of talent. And this is really the show. We'll see it a lot with Survivor Series over the year. I think it kind of becomes a show in this mold. But it's really becoming a show. It's a show here that starts the kind of the era that, you know, and this really isn't an old joke, Scott, but your era is a little bit before. So I think for me and Greg and a guy like Aaron or, you know, what, like kind of the era that we grew up with as fans, like the guys that we know best as kids. And that's, you know,
right.
Mr. Perfect and Rick Rude as a heel and Demolition as the faces and Powers of Pain as heel. You know, like that, like this right now is like when I came in, like this is the group that we're about to see over the next year and a half. Is kind of the era I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that here as like a big transition show to that era.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you on that. But yeah, I think the business in general and Vince's vision in general was growing and flourishing. The roster was flourishing. And I think the Bulldogs were kind of outgrowing that culture. And particularly Dynamite, who wasn't going to get along with anybody. Mm-hmm. So, I think it was just a perfect time for them to go and kind of change their scenery. So, I think it worked out for them in the long run. Well, definitely worked out for
worked out for Davey.
Davey in the long run. Yeah,
exactly. He benefited, okay. So, Dynamite, anyway. Not so much.
Yeah.
So. All right, it is main event time, and it is an interesting one, as the Mega Powers are co-captains here tonight, teaming with... I don't know where they found this team or decided to put this team together, but pairing with Hercules, Hillbilly Jim, and Coco Beware to take on co-captains the Twin Towers, Big Boss Man, and Akeem, with Haku, the Red Rooster, and Ted DiBiase. Before we get to the construct of these teams, Scott, I think we mentioned briefly in our notes Akeem, but we haven't seen him yet. In September 88, mm-hmm. One Man Gang's manager Slick announced that the gang was actually African and planned to re-embrace his roots on an episode of Superstars, which aired on September 24th, 1988, featured a vignette with Gene Okerlund on location in an American ghetto that was dubbed the deepest, darkest parts of Africa, where dancers dressed as tribal Africans danced and chanted around a fire. Slick announced that gang would be known by his new name, Akeem the African Dream, even though Okerlund immediately called him his one-man gang. Vignette received some criticism as a Caucasian Akeem delivered a promo in which he spoke stereotypical jive and danced in the style of Dusty Rhodes while an African ritual took place in the background. So I think something that would never fly today, but fuck it, I don't care. You know my love for Akeem. I stand by it. He's a brilliant, brilliant character. I love him so much. His selling, his dancing is so over the top and absurd. It's what I love about wrestling. So welcome to my life, Akeem. I enjoy excited to have you here for the next year and a half.
Me too. I remember you talking about this being our era, and Akeem was one of my absolute favorites as a kid. I don't know too many kids that watched wrestling at the time that didn't try to do the Akeem dance.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of fun there. My dad loved him. My mom loved him. Just a fun character.
Did it bother you, Scott, at all? It's kind of someone who had been more grown up with the gang. Like, by the time when I came in, it was just Akeem. Like, I hadn't really seen One Man Gang, so.
No, it didn't bother me. I thought it was a better character for, again, a lot of these guys that came in from other territories, the gimmick they brought with them just didn't fit what Vince needed. And Vince needed better heels and kind of gimmicky yet vicious heels. And I think Akeem was perfect for what mm-hmm. Vince needed. So I had no problem with it. And I mean, if we're talking about the whole, you know, becoming African, even though he's a white guy, I mean, we're talking about Hercules as a slave. So, I mean, right. I think everything, I think all bets are off in any of that.
No, yeah, we're getting a ledgy with our race relations here at late 88.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But yeah, so we had mentioned, I think previously too, Scott, that the Big Boss Man had attacked Hogan on the Brother Love Show. So that's what's bringing the Mega Powers and the Twin Towers together. And John D'Amato wanted us to remind everyone that Hulk Hogan was trained by Hiro Matsuza, so don't forget that as well. All right, so here we go, main event time. The new top heels have emerged in the fall. DiBiase is still in the mix, but has been phased down a bit. Akeem has arrived to bring the gang to relevance, and the heel team calls out to Jive Soul Bro, which is just a fucking dream. Six guys, seven guys strutting out to Jive Soul Bro. Peak pro wrestling. Weird face team. A couple of low mid-carders here giving a shot. Hercules, really elevating him up to be kind of a third mega power in a way. They're at least trying to get him on that level. I don't understand the Coco and Jim stuff. Like, I guess they wanted to balance all the teams, but I'm surprised they didn't just stick, like, Beefcake and Tito here or something. You know what I mean? Like, just to give them more credence on their team. That surprises me. Anyway, Jesse gets his classic line in here that Kokabura's hair is fried, dyed, and laid to the side. So there you go. Hogan comes out last to his theme, gets a big pop. Savage and Ted fittingly open things up, and the crowd is here for it. Savage wins the battle and tags Herc, but Ted runs away and baits him into getting stomped by the Rooster. Herc bows up and tags Coco, but he finds himself having to deal with Akeem and then Haku. Coco dodges the leg drop and tags Herc, who trades blows with the King. Hogan tags in and smacks King around and then tags Hillbillies. Gorilla reminds us of their relationship from back in the day. The heels take turns working over Jim until the Rooster tries and fails to slam him. Jim takes back over with his antics and tags Coco. Rooster goes to the head, but that fails, and Coco hits a perfect missile dropkick for two. Hogan comes in, and Rooster stands no chance as Hogan drops him with a big boot, slams him, and Savage hits the elbow for the elimination. He done. Hogan is pissed, and he's embarrassed as Rooster stumbles away. We finally settle down with Savage and Haku for a moment until Hulk tags in. Hulk shakes off some offense and slams Haku hard and tags Herc. Haku comes back with a back suplex and tags Akeem. Jim ends up in there and gets a flurry, but eventually gets squished in the corner and then eats a splash and heads to the locker room as the match is evened up. Coco comes in with a dropkick and sticks and moves before tagging Hogan. Him and Macho and then Herc all rattle Akeem. Coco comes in but gives Akeem daylight, and Bossman hits a side slam to eliminate him. Hogan steps in. The crowd's pumped to see him and Bossman throw down. Hogan batters him, but he can't get him off his feet, despite unloading with a lot of artillery. Hogan slams Bossman with ease, finally gets him down, and then walks into a real nice spinebuster. Bossman hammers away for a bit, tags Ted, but Hogan fires up and slugs away before tagging Herc. Jesse says, "This is horrible. A slave doing this to his master." Brutal stuff.
We're talking about Akeem.
Brutal. As Herc beats on his nemesis, Virgil trips up Herc, allowing Ted to roll him up for the win. The mega power is suddenly in a deep hole, but it's their own fault. They assembled this dog shit team. Savage sneaks in and rolls up Ted, sending him packing in a pretty surprising elimination. And they're pretty much finally done now. Savage and Hulk trade off. And I think it also ends Ted's main event run. I think this is like the final salvo. He'll get a blip here and there, but as far as like a, you know, ongoing main event threat, this is pretty much it. Savage and Hulk trade off dealing with Haku until Hulk gets caught with a kick and Bossman takes over. The Towers and Haku pick apart Hogan for a while and they have him dead to rights, but Bossman fucks around while Slick yells at him. Jesse's questioning what's going on. Bossman goes up top. He comes up empty on a splash. Savage gets the tag and cleans house, but gets cut down while Slick stalks Liz outside and drags her to the aisle. Hogan makes a save and drops the Slickster. Akeem jumps Hogan, and the Towers beat him up and cuff him to the bottom rope. And we find out that Bossman was counted out during all this, so he just starts beating the shit out of Hogan with the nightstick. Haku keeps beating on Savage during this playing out. And then Bossman comes back in. Him and Akeem destroy Macho using the nightstick. And then Akeem gets disqualified. And all this is real messy, but it protects the Towers because they're in here with this main event run now with Hogan and Savage. And it builds a lot of heat on them as well, so I'm fine with that. The Towers leave as Haku keeps working on Savage. Savage dodges an elbow and tries to tag, but Hulk Hogan's not there. Jesse says the ref made Slick come out and has the key to the handcuffs. Slick taunts Hogan as Haku gets back on the champ. Haku accidentally nails Slick. Hogan pelts Heenan, and then Liz comes over and takes the keys and frees Hogan. Savage eventually makes a tag, and Hulk easily polishes off Haku to end things. Hogan celebrates a bit aggressively with Liz, and that gets a side eye from Savage. Pretty good stuff here that really picked up once the scrubs were all gone. I thought the back end was pretty hot with a lot of heat building and angle progression. And I thought this was all about the Mega Powers and furthering their angle and bringing the Twin Towers up to their level. So we get all of that. And it brings closure to Savage DiBiase as well, phases him down, no longer really a top player. I thought it was a solid end to a good show. I went 3 stars on this one, Greg.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I really like this one a lot. 3 stars for me as well. And, you know, I could even see an argument for going higher than that because I really dug it. I thought my childhood nostalgia made me a mark for pretty much the entire face team. loved Coco, loved Hillbilly Jim for some reason, liked Hercules, and then, of course, loved the Mega Powers when I was a kid. And I thought everybody was pretty good here, except, you know, I don't understand the Red Rooster character. Like, I don't understand him, especially as a heel.
And we haven't actually talked about that. I'll just real quick, I'll cut in. Scott, sure. We talked about Terry Taylor. We haven't really gotten into the Rooster things. I don't think we've seen him as the Rooster yet. But real quick, the background on that. So Taylor turned heel, acquired Bobby Heenan as his manager, and got rebranded the Red Rooster with the red tights, the ring coat. And I think it was just that Heenan the idea was that Taylor's kind of a novice and couldn't navigate his way through matches without constant instructions from Heenan. And doesn't Heenan give him the gimmick to prove that he could take anyone and make him a star, like even this goof with this weird gimmick? I think that was pretty much the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. Like, I don't know why they decided Red Rooster would be a good name, like, unless they eventually thought he'd become the Rooster, like actual Rooster. So I don't really get it. Like, but I'm pretty sure that's the genesis, that Heenan wanted to prove he could take any bum and with a stupid gimmick, basically, and make him a star.
Yeah, because there's nothing more cringeworthy in this match than whenever, like, Hulk Hogan's in the ring. It's like, oh, Hogan finally got his hands on the Rooster.
Right?
For
so the
God's
first
sake.
Time he was called the Rooster was October 15th. On TV, and he's working that. I'm trying to see if Graham has anything. It's pretty much he just is the Rooster. So it must have been worked through commentary, but I'm pretty sure that was the whole thought process behind it.
Yeah. Vince pitching that gimmick must have been quite a.
You're an actual Rooster, pal.
poor Terry Taylor, Terrence Taylor, if you
he
will.
Sucks,
but I thought it was a good match. I really enjoyed the work from everybody. Akeem was awesome. I love the gimmick. I know it's racist. I know it's in poor taste, but I can't help it. I enjoyed it so much as a kid. And Big Boss Man is really good. Haku. Okay, that's the one element of this match that I think could put it over the top. They should have had it probably come down to DiBiase instead of Haku, because mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys agree. I felt like the crowd even kind of died just a little bit
right.
when it was down to Haku, because nobody believed that Haku was going to beat Randy Savage
right.
or Hulk Hogan, much less both of them.
Right, yeah, DiBiase at least is somewhat of a threat. I agree. And we'll see that again actually at our next pay-per-view too. They kind of follow the same pattern and it hurts them again. My favorite Terry Taylor fact, by the way, was that he was not even nominated for the GWWE project we did last year. And I love it because everyone got a fucking nomination. Like everyone. And there's so many guys on that list that got at least one nomination. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But no one cared enough to give Terry Taylor even a courtesy nomination.
I'm pretty sure Terry Taylor's dad wasn't even a wrestler and Lee West nominated him.
Anyway, were you done there, Greg?
I'm done, yeah.
All right, Scott.
All right. I thought the overall pacing and the match itself was really good. I gave it 3.5. Savage is still crazy over Hogan's Hogan. The heel team is solid. I wouldn't say it's great. I feel like DiBiase already is turning into kind of like a forgotten guy now. I mm-hmm. think his, you know, that stretch is over. It seemed weird because it's really only been a year.
Yeah, but he's been constant. I mean, how many matches is he going to get with Savage? It's ridiculous.
True. Oh,
point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's just amazing how fast it was. Oh, no, I agree.
Oh, yeah.
It's just amazing how fast it was in such a short period of time, in barely a year. The only thing that really bugged me, I get where we're going and where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesse, I feel like – not Jesse. Gorilla, like, really pushes it when he really doesn't have to. Like, when Savage gets thrown in the corner and, you know, Hogan tags him and goes in, Jesse goes, oh, but he tags Hogan. And then Gorilla has to say, well, he didn't really tag him. He kind of fell into the
right.
corner. Like, why do we have to – like, I mean, already we got to think Savage is a fucking schlub? Already? Can we let this fucking happen before we already start treating him like dirt? I mean, I thought Gorilla, and this happens a lot, and I love Gorilla. Believe me, I do. But he had a habit of kind of quickly, the minute like Vince probably said in production meetings, okay, start hinting that Savage is not at Hogan's level,
right.
and Gorilla just fucking jumps on it, where you really don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
Let it happen. Did you really have to? Oh, it wasn't really a tag per se. I'm like, I thought that was a bit much. I thought that the the whole Hogan, you know, fucking throwing Elizabeth up in the air like a cheerleader, I think was enough of a thing for Savage to look at him and go, "What are you doing?" But other than that, I thought the part of the match that was really building when Hogan was handcuffed and Savage is getting a tar beat out of him was really building to the end. Like, I thought it was telling a really good emotional story at that moment. And I love Jesse when Elizabeth's looking for the key. She's pickpocketing Slick's wallet. It was actually very funny. The commentary was great, except for that one moment with Gorilla. And I thought the match itself was great. I thought that everybody did, you know, played their part. And yes, the seed was planted. Not as subtle, except for, you know, Gorilla pretty much acknowledging that Savage really didn't do a tag. I thought that everybody worked hard. I thought Akeem and Bossman really come off as monster studs. Mm-hmm. They really do. I mean, subjectivity aside, JR, of your love for them. I mean, I think they really just got over as just a powerhouse team. Like, I think we talk about the 10 tag teams in the tag match, but you can already see the seeds of Akeem and Bossman as just a team to be reckoned with, you know? So much stuff in this match is more than you think. And it made it for such a great storytelling. Savage is still your champion. Hogan's still Hogan. But yes, you see the side look. But it's subtle. And then we move on. And they still celebrate. So I thought top to bottom, good storytelling. The in-ring was fine for what it was. And Terry Taylor is a bum. I don't know if his reputation is just trash or... I mean, there's a lot of people that...
No, he's just whatever.
I don't know.
It's utterly forgettable.
Yeah.
But if not for him, we would have never had the York Foundation.
True.
But in any event, solid match, good storytelling, and we end on a happy note, as all pay-per-views are.
Okay. All right, let's get to our awards before we wrap things up. Match of the night. I mean, I went with the tag. That Andre match, that wasn't too far behind for me at this point. I really like that one. Greg, what did you have?
The Andre match was great.
Oh, I know, Scott, yours, but what did you have, Greg?
I had the Andre match. Okay. I thought it was the standout for me.
All right. Team Andre.
A lot of more typing than normal for the award.
God, I can't type
for the award. Yeah.
Okay. The Cousin Junior, which is our worst match of the night. It wasn't really fair. It's tough when you have these short cards. I went with the Warrior versus Honky. I'm guessing we're all on the same boat on that one.
Yeah. I mean, it was the worst of the four, I guess, which doesn't seem
bad.
Much.
It's
awful
just the
match.
Worst of the four. Yeah.
I guess I technically gave the tag match a lower rating, so I'll put the tag match there for me.
All right. Kind of went a little too far with that one, Greg.
I know.
All right. The Andre the Giant Award, our newly christened MVP award. I went with Andre the Giant. Not a surprise. He's been awesome all year. Scott?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would give the edge to the Demolition Powers of Pain combo, but Andre's just, oh, my God. I mean, he was just amazing. Not caring about rules, being vicious, and, again, whatever storyline he's about to go into, he gets it going. And, yeah, amazing.
I'm going with Randy Savage. I thought his selling and his just – energy carried the main event to being something pretty good when it you know, outside of his work, it could have gotten boring really fast.
Okay. The newly christened Sandy Beach Award for the worst worker of the night. I thought Danny Davis clearly stood out. Usually, you know, you got Bravo out there, you got Boris out there, so a lot of competition tonight, but to me, Davis was the worst and most worthless on the evening here.
I don't know. Bravo comes pretty close.
And he at least had the celebration moment, which was funny.
That's all the work rate you're giving him.
Yeah, if I mean something. More than Davis did.
All right. I'll go with Danny Davis because he was pretty much cooked too.
I'm gonna go with the Warlord. I thought the Warlord was really bad. I thought Barb was good, and I thought Warlord was really bad out there.
Okay. All right. Off the beaten path. All right. Best, a sad one. Well, it's a surprise that you pick Warlord for a worst worker, but that's where we are with this card. All right. Best moment. I mean, I don't know. Was it actually the best moment? I think it's probably the most important to come out of the show and the biggest, and that's Demolition's face turn. I mean, it's such a big deal for them to go face and become the real torchbearers of the promotion. The runner-up for me would be Andre murdering Tito during that. He just crushed his chest in and then pinned him. Or even him just choking the shit out of Jake and getting DQ'd. So close runs up there. But Demolition turning face is, like, the ultimate moment from the show for me.
I agree. It was the biggest storyline moment. Needed to happen. It's glad that we have it, like, out now.
Mm-hmm.
Andre killing everybody was awesome. And the Savage eye look, but that was more subtle. That's not one that's to be pointed out, but mm-hmm. the Demolition face turn to me clearly was the biggest thing to come out of this.
Yeah, that was the biggest, but I gotta go Andre just wanting to seeming to be murdering Jake the Snake before our very eyes. That was horrifying to watch and yet so awesome.
Yeah, that's a tough, those are tough ones to choose between. All right, the Morocco Award for the most juiced up on the evening. I went with Dino Bravo, who I think will be getting the name the award named after him soon enough.
Yes.
Any disagreement there?
Well, with Morocco gone now, Bravo's will now have won it 1-2.
Yeah, it's his fourth straight. Three, well, D'Amato gave it to him last
fifth straight.
Time.
Yeah.
I got to go Dino as well, but runner up to Davey Boy.
Yeah, he was juiced big time. All right, I think as his final farewell, his Lifetime Achievement Award, the Ken Patera Award for the worst hair of the night goes to Ken Patera.
Ken Patera,
he's
going
to wear it, win it one last time. So yep. He has to, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times Ken Patera has won the award since its inception, named after him. So his final time winning the award. Coco with his fried dyed and laid to the side did not get it, but
that should have been his t-shirt, fried dyed laid to the side. Should have been the one t-shirt they made for him.
You should start using that at the Knights of Columbus breakfasts. Pies, fries, and bacon on the side.
Bacon on the side. I think I might do that.
All right, overall grade out of 10, I went 6.5. I enjoyed the show. It did lag at times. I hate to say because it's such a good visual with all the teams, but you almost wonder if they could have had a fifth match in there somewhere, and I don't know how they could have done it, but that match being so long definitely makes the card drag a bit, and the opener is kind of shaky, and there's some slow spots. But overall, it's a fun watch. It's a fairly quick watch. I dug it. I think it's a notch behind 87 Survivor Series, which I like more as a whole. I went 8 on that show, so I think it's a bit lesser than that one, but still fun, and there's still a lot going on, so... what'd you have, Greg, on this?
Same score, 6.5. I thought it was an entertaining watch. Flows so much faster, even with the lulls, than a lot of modern shows do. And ultimately, though, I just didn't love any of the matches enough to go any higher than that. So,
all right, Scott.
Well, I gave 87 a 7.5, and I'm just looking back at what I graded those matches, and I gave that a 2.5, a 3, and 2 4s.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I gave the tag match a 4, and I gave this one only a half star more. So I'm actually going to grade this. I gave that one a 7.5, so I'm going to give this one a 7.5 as well.
Mm.
I thought it was equally as good as last year's. Match quality was really good. Obviously, we had some great storyline advancement. Crowd was hot. Everybody was working that has the ability to work, not like Danny Davis or any of those guys, but commentary was great. Just everything worked on this night. It was a good night of wrestling, good night for the crowd. So it works for me, 7.5, just like last year.
All right, that brings us to the end of our show here tonight. Hopefully everyone enjoyed this look back at Survivor Series. If, like we said earlier, pretty fitting, it is Thanksgiving week. Lots going on. Scott, you'll be here over the weekend. So I'll see you for a few days. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with the November 88 House Show with another new making his debut here inside the Vintage Vault. So that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And right around the corner, of course, will be our Christmas Spectacular. So be sure to stay tuned for that. Other news, I think there's hints of a new Wrestling Warzone maybe coming this week. Also hints out on social media. I don't know if you've seen the rumors that Jeff Learns Wrestling may be returning in the next couple of weeks as well. And of course, always stay tuned for new episodes of No Holds Barred with me and Aaron as we continue to finalize our GWE tag teams list. And like I said earlier, if you want in on the project and you're not already part, just reach out. And anyone can submit a list, whether you're in the conversation or not. So keep an eye out on that. What do you got, Scott? Main event this week? Was it last week? I forget.
Main event was this past week. Take a look at if Nate and I got our Survivor Series and TakeOver picks correct. And, of course,
yes,
we did
no.
the most recent, kind of a split. And our most recent TNA Classic pay-per-view recap. Also coming up in a couple of weeks, we will be debuting a new podcast.
It'll
be a new podcast debuting on the PTBM Pop Feed. So that'll be sometime in the next couple of weeks. So check out the Pop Feed very closely for a new paper, a new pay-per-view, a new podcast debuting. And actually, we were talking about the GWWE as well, myself and Brother Nate. And I think Steve Willie will be joining us as well on Main Event to do his list as well. So like Nate and I did last year for the GWWE singles wrestlers, as we head into 2019, we'll be doing our recapping our
I don't know if I can live through another one of Nate's fucking lists. We'll see.
He promised there'd be. He promised that he wouldn't put Doom. So,
God. All right. Speaking of the Pop Feed, Greg, what do you got going on? Anything you want to plug?
Oh man, yeah. The Pop Feed is popping every single week here at Place to Be Nation. Pop, pop, and we have every week, of course, the hard traveling fanboys. This week we are taking a look. We're doing a countdown, actually. Later this week, of our top five Stan Lee creations in honor of his recent passing. Just last week, we had the Village Bicycle of Place to Be Nation Pop, Jennifer Smith, stop by the Hard Traveling Studios.
Not just Pop. She's just the Village Bicycle of all Place to Be Nation because she's written stuff. She's on the wrestling feed, on the Pop feed. Yes. It's everywhere.
And so she swung by to talk about Green Lantern Earth 1. Nick and I have a might have a football thing coming up soon. We're not really sure. We're batting that around. And I'm trying to think of anything else we've got going on. Oh, yes, the end of this month, the long-awaited 2018 Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Comics Fantasy Comics Draft presented by a hypothetical non-rotational DC Comics online unlimited subscription service. We will finally have our pitches podcast where Nick and I are joined by Jennifer, Tim, Todd, Russell, and newcomer Mitch Oaken to discuss our pitches for our fantasy comics draft. We even had a ballot submitted by WWE official Jason Ayers.
There you go. Very nice.
All right.
I thought you were going to say by Place to Be podcast co-host Justin Rosero, but that's okay.
No, I only mentioned the important ones.
Mm. It's Mags, I didn't pick any of your shit.
Damn it.
That's a lie, I did. Anyway, be sure to listen to that and everything else. It's always a good time on the Pop Feed. And may I'll come on and talk something with you, Greg. I've actually now watched... I obtained a list from Todd Weber of the order I should watch these Marvel shows on Netflix. Because I needed new watching at the gym. So I've watched all of Daredevil Season 1. And I'm halfway through Jessica Jones Season 1. So
awesome. That one, Jessica Jones in particular, is a one close to both my heart and Nick's cheese-guarded heart. So we might have to have you on to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. So yeah, maybe when I finish Season 1, we can come on and give you my moldy thoughts on Season 1. But no, it's been a good time because I needed something new after I finished all the Breaking Bad stuff. I needed something new at the gym to keep me entertained, and it was suggested to me that I should try those out. So I am. There I am.
Very good.
All right, let's get the fuck out of here. I get an early flight in the morning. So, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining, Greg. We'll have you back on soon. Otherwise, we'll talk to everyone else in 2 weeks. Bye.